portfolio committee. I want us to just spend some time with the researchers and the content advisors just to get our draft report for the public hearings, which you can imagine takes a whole lot of work. Just to get a draft before the portfolio committee. So next week, unless you hear something to the contrary, we may not meet on Tuesday. You will, however, be invited to a session, perhaps with the drafters and the content advisors, just an informal kind of meeting, a working meeting, so to speak. If you do have the time and the commitment to do so, please do that, so that we can start the process of compiling our draft report, interim report, of course, so far. The other housekeeping detail, let me immediately just welcome Mr. Dikobo from ZAPO, who's a new member of the committee, although he's an alternate with the other minority parties. Mr. Dikobo has undertaken to me in blood that he will try and prioritize basic education. Very welcome to you, sir. And it's going to be a while, you will know, before I remember your name, because to this day I still call Ms. Gina Ms. Mashishi, and I call Mr. Makubela the ghost worker, and so on. But you'll get used to the antics of the chairperson. I mean, my mother, too, this is a genetic condition. My mother still calls me my sister's name. So it's entirely genetic. There's nothing I can do about it. I cannot unlearn the behavior. It's ingrained in my DNA, and that's about that. But very welcome to you, and we do hope that you will be you'll find this committee an interesting place, and I'm certain that your contribution will be very welcome. We also have a visiting guest, Mr. Hadebe, who is in his full Africa splendor. Welcome to you. It's always good to have some color in this committee. Between you and Mr. Haniako, we have all the colors of the rainbow. So thank you very much for the two of you showing this much enthusiasm. Giving us some personality. Welcome to all our guests here today participating in our public hearings. This is the third session, I believe. Third session of our public, fourth session, Mr. Brown tells me. I'm obviously losing my mind completely. I have to explain over and over again because people don't quite understand the process of public participation, and we're a bit overwhelmed, myself and Mr. Brown, with queries about how people can come and participate in these oral sessions in Parliament, and why is it that certain organizations are excluded, et cetera, et cetera. Just to contextualize it for you so that you are able to also disseminate this information to your colleagues and people who work in the areas that you also work in. We called for written submissions towards the end of last year. This was advertised in newspapers, in magazines, in stakeholder publications, etc. And we received quite a few written submissions by the due date, which was the end of February. From those written submissions, we are now in the process of identifying people who can come to what I call the oral phase, which is the phase of the public hearing. We can't obviously see every single person and every institution that has made submissions. And so what we do is we sit down as a small little subcommittee and we decide on the following basis. The first is, if somebody offers a different perspective from the usual submissions that we've received, we tend to favor an oral hearing from such an institution or such a person. If the submission that is made be worth our while to further engage, we then invite the individual or the institution to this phase. And thirdly, we invite submissions that offer different views. In other words, offers different solutions perhaps to the kinds of challenges that everybody speaks about when they come to the public hearing. Once the oral hearing phase is over, we will, as a committee, the multi-party committee that you see in front of you, be going through every single submission that we've received. And at this stage, it's about 189 submissions. 100 and? Yeah. 272 now. That's simply because we continue receiving written submissions and we haven't turned anybody away even after the closing date. But certainly the people who have submitted to us after the closing date cannot expect to be coming here to the oral hearings. So it's really in light of all of that that we will then be looking at the written submissions, all of them, the 272, and God knows how old we'll be by the time we get through all of that. And we'll be drafting a report and drafting and agreeing to recommendations which we hope to make to the department. The department, by the way, is kindly offered to be present at these hearings in the form of Mrs. Chubeka over there, and the department will be taking copious notes even during these during this phase, simply because there are processes currently underway. You might have heard of the curriculum review process that is currently underway, and they feed into that process even before we submit a report to the department. The report we're hoping will only be, seeing as it's 272, I imagine will only be out next year. But once that report is out, it will be debated in the full house, in the full chamber, and then submitted to the department as recommendations from this portfolio committee for implementation. And that's really how we see the public hearings coming to fruition. So I hope that explains a little bit more about the process and that people don't see these engagements really, because it's what it is, really engagements with yourself, as the end of it all. So with that in mind, and having spoken for a good number of minutes, I think we better get started because we are on a tight schedule this afternoon. And I take it that we've got SA Media, Ms. Van der Berg. I take it you guys are set up. Lovely. Won't you please begin? We're going to take 10 minutes, and then we have about 15 to 20 minutes engagement with yourself before we see the next institution. So perhaps you want to start by just giving us a brief overview of who you are and an introduction to your organization, yeah? Welcome.
Well, Chairperson, honorable members, thank you very much for the opportunity of showcasing our proposal that we had submitted before the deadline. My name is Vadim Schreiner. I'm responsible for business development at SA Media, and with me is my colleague Hester Van der Berg, who is the operations manager. We represent SA Media.
You might want to just give me your name again.
Okay. I wrote it in there on top of the presentation as well. Vadim Schreiner for business development, Hester Van der Berg, operations manager. Ah, no. Okay. You represent SA Media, which is a division of the University of the Free State. A little bit of introduction as to the reasons why we submitted the proposal that we have. SA Media is an organization that follows what the media are writing, and according to the media, the education in this country is in a severe crisis. Again, this is at least what we have to go and assess when we are listening to the media. Media are writing that the OBE school curriculum is being revised as a matter of priority, and Honorable Chairperson has indicated that as well. The PRLS results for South Africa that were conducted, I believe, last year, indicated that South Africa is the standards. The UCT did a national benchmarking test where they asked 13,000 undergraduate students to go and participate. Of these 13,000, 50% and more came out with a minimum acceptable standard of literacy and numeracy. And out of 26,000 plus public schools, only a little bit more than 8% in fact have had functional libraries. And we believe that the cost for establishing new libraries are in the region of 120 million rand, if one estimates 5 million per library. This excludes, of course, any of the other additional costs. Before we actually go into what it is that we're doing, I'd like to just hand over to my colleague Esther, who can go and speak a little bit about the history of SMEDIA behind.
Thank you very much. The history of the SMEDIA. SMEDIA was started in 1972 as part of an archive at the then Orange Free State University. And it was in formed as a request for the Parliament. They needed people to monitor the SA print press, and then they asked us to do that. But very soon it was, they saw that it was best to sort of make it a national service, because everybody, there wasn't any other press cutting service at that stage in history. So we started it, and then we worked ourselves up at this stage, Parliament, all the provincial parliaments, all the universities are subscribed to SMEDIA at this stage. So in 1994, we also had companies and NGOs that were part of SMEDIA then. Then, as I say, we started with the old card system. Then we worked onto the microfiche, and initially in 1978, we digitalized every article that was still in microfiche. So now everything is available online since 1998. Then since 2009, we have started a JV with the Timbador Holdings and see what they can do to make SMEDIA more efficient, improve our service, return on investment, and increase the R&D. And then just a few stats on SMEDIA. As I say, we started in 1978, so at this stage, we've got about 4.6 million articles available. We update it on a yearly basis, but by about 120,000 articles. We've analyzed and have basically 80% of our publications, Afrikaans and English, on our database. Then what makes SMEDIA unique is the fact that we've got a specific keyword list of thesaurus that we use to analyze these articles and make them available to people. We also got a specific topic list. We've got 23 topics that we've divided in, like Africa or Parliament or education, labor, etc., etc. So there's 23 of these that we can make use of to get specific articles that you are looking for on a database. In general, there are about 1.5 million searches that are annually done by independent people or people that are making use of SMEDIA itself in Bloemfontein, so they do searches and get their articles. As I've mentioned earlier, many people are subscribed to SMEDIA, or the parliaments, universities, the provincial libraries, and at this stage, we have a limited services to schools regarding to debates from the article FEAR and NELM, that we compile packages for them, for children that taking a part in the debates to use those articles for their debates, because everything is nowadays contemporary things that they are looking for. SMEDIA is a subscription base, so you have to subscribe to SMEDIA to make use of it, and then you get an ID and a password so you can use SMEDIA. When you subscribe to SMEDIA, you get training provided, and we're always there to help you with any requests for the people that are subscribed to SMEDIA. Now I'm going quickly to show you how SMEDIA do a search on SMEDIA. This is just an introduction. When you don't have a newspaper, you can't even do the news on the television. That was when the television started in the 1970s, so that's why this bloke is looking for some newspapers to read his news. This is SA Media's introduction page. There's a little bit of history on it, and then on the left side you get the ID and the login password that you needed to subscribe to SA Media, to use SA Media. This is our search screen. On your left side, on my left side, is all the topics that we have. We have, at the stage, we have 46 topics, but as history changed, so we chose our topics as well. And on my left side is all the newspapers that are published and was published and still published. At this stage, we've got about 60 newspapers and periodicals or magazines that we are using. Then you go down there, you can do searches by date, and then as I say, you need specific keywords to do searches, and then you can do your search. I've done a search here on education and research, and there were 6 specific articles that I might use of, so that is what you get as a result, and then I've taken one out of it, then you get your topic, it's education and natural science, and then the publication, then you get the heading of the article. That's one thing that they have implemented on a later date, because sometimes the person only knows the heading, and then we can help them with that as well. Then our keywords are available in Afrikaans and English, so it doesn't matter which way you look for a specific article, you get it. And then on your far left right side is the date of the newspaper, and then otherwise you can open it either a PDF or a TIFF address. You can open the article. And there's the article that I've done, the Earn for Learning. So now you can decide, you can have the article, you can print it, or you can save it, or you can just read it if you want to, if it's a specific article that you need. This specific article got the exact page that the newspaper wants, because that's one thing that researchers actually need for all the researchers, is the right page of the newspaper. And that's one thing that you don't get on the internet in itself on a search. That's one of the main things on it as well. This is our thesaurus. This is the way that we do a query. I've put in research. You can either put in a whole word or a part of a word between asterisks, and you'll find it. There's all the results with research in it as a specific opening keyword. And then on the right side, the blue is the specific keyword that you can use. And then a double click, and then it will give you the search screen, and then you can do your search on the articles that's so easily. And that's basically how SA Media works. So now Vadim will give us a little bit more.
So as Hester indicated, SA Media is essentially a collection of newspaper articles, all newspaper articles printed in English and Afrikaans press since 1975, available, categorized. The proposal that we have submitted in our documentation at the beginning of the year had a couple of mentions, and this is for discussion purposes. Our thoughts that we have compiled. First of all, the offering that SA Media at the moment has, it would go and bring current affairs to all the public schools in this country. With the help of that information of current affairs and newspaper articles easily accessible, categorized, it would go and allow the development of analytical skills. It additionally assists with reading, particularly in languages of both English and Afrikaans. It assists with better class assignments. In other words, no matter what the pupil or the teacher is currently doing with being in natural science, being in geography, in history, in languages, and mathematics, there is information available that newspapers have reported about it. It's up to date and it's long and it can go and be used in context and it can go and be analyzed in terms of over time. As I mentioned, it can be used by both teachers to go and support whatever documentation they're submitting that they're using in class. But it can also go and be used by students for assignments or for projects. It does require online access because the database at this point of time is on a server, but that information, we've been doing this for the last couple of years, can also go and be delivered on request via post. So in other words, schools or institutions that don't have internet access can go and call and can go and say, we are busy with an assignment or we're busy with a project, and that is the type of information that we are requesting. The research is then done at SA Media in Bloemfontein, and the relevant clippings are then couriered or sent to those schools in advance for those particular projects. One of the common questions that we are getting is, you know, but all the media is already in any case available online, and that's not the case. Not all South African print publications. even if they have a specific web presence, there's always a difference between the online content and the print content. And of course, the online content was only really developed in the last 10 years, so prior to this, there's nothing that's essentially available in terms of newspaper coverage, but SM Media has it going back to 1975. It looks like a newspaper. It's quite important to look on to your research that there's a look and feel. Well, you don't really have the feel of the actual newspaper anymore, but at least you've got the look. You know how it's been written, and it has the context and the feel of a newspaper. It requires less online skills than a web usage. In other words, in order to go on to proper searches through Google or through those particular newspaper websites, you need to be quite internet savvy to go and use Boolean searches or other terms. With SM Media, it's relatively straightforward. There's a set of criteria. If you don't know what criteria to use, there's a help file. You can go and look it up. It's a very smart thesaurus. So where others have got Boolean string searches using ands and ors and, you know, excluding certain things with inverted commas or stars, this one is relatively straightforward in terms of what it has. The online access to the media is considerably cheaper than traditional newspaper subscriptions. I'm not at the moment privy what it costs to go and subscribe, but I would go and say that to subscribe to any newspaper is probably in the region of about a couple of thousand rand. This particular access is much, much less cost intense. And the items can go and be printed out for class assignments, they can go and be saved for further usage, they can go and be archived. And I've mentioned earlier on, for those without internet access, there's always the possibility of delivering that information through any of the other means and ways that are existing. Additionally, we are providing training for each and every institution or organization that would like to go and be involved in such a project, and it gets done on a repeated basis, not just once a year. So the aim of our proposal that we've submitted is essentially to increase access to the media and to current affairs in schools, and to improve the knowledge of current affairs through those particular clippings, which means we are creating more informed citizens. I think that is also the aim, not only us as an organization, but as a country as a whole. With that, we are closing our submissions, and of course, we'll be happy to go and answer your questions.
I remember one of my first experiences at school when it came to reading classes was we had to literally go home at night, cut out a little article, and come and read it in the morning in the classroom. And really, it seemed to me that that was the kind of exercise that most kids, in a sense, lack today in a real sense. But also, one of the interesting developments, shall I say, over the period since I've been in school, and that's been a hell of a long time, so one could appreciate that there would be quite a few developments, not for the better, I might just add. We do have quite a lot of reporting that is just not suitable for kids in our media. And that would be my primary question to you, is do you actually look at the kind of content where, for example, we have some really tabloid prints going on today, and apparently they're the most widely read and really well. But if we were to suggest that one of the ways, and I take it this is what your input really amounts to, that one of the ways in which we can perhaps mitigate the deficiencies of our infrastructure in terms of school libraries and so on would be to perhaps get schools to subscribe to SM Media and so on. But clearly, it would seem to me, without really understanding how this thing works, is that reluctance? So, you know, is the kind of literature that would be available, the kind of reading material, as much as the current affairs and so on, but is it appropriate, really, for our kids to be exposed, particularly at a younger age in primary school where you're learning to read? Is this an appropriate tool, really?
I think so. We are very the criteria that we need must be articles that are worthwhile for research purposes. We don't do those tabloid newspapers because there really isn't anything worthwhile to put on our system. And as I say, our database is for the purpose to help our children and our students to be more aware of everything that's going on, but not the sensational sort of stuff. That is not part of our policy all the years that we are doing SA Media. So, no, they won't. And we have specific topics where we only do certain little things that are in the newspaper or that's something that can help a child in primary school. Even we've got specific keywords using that. So a little child that's still in primary school can come to us and then we can help him, even if it's something like there was on all the animals, the national animals or the big five and that sort of stuff. We do have something like that on it just for, so you can do that own reading on that and see what it is and that sort of stuff. Because you don't get it anywhere. Nowadays it's difficult finding it. So yes, we do primarily go for everyone we can help to develop and their skills and that sort of stuff. And we don't have that sensational sort of stuff on it. So it's not really harmful to any children.
However, as a bit of a disclaimer, there's of course certain coverage that is going to go and be viewed in a different way. We do have, for instance, carrier coverage on accidents that have happened or on debates, and they might embed it in the article, have pictures which, you know, perhaps show, you know, I'll be cutting them out. But it might, what I'm saying is, we're not impacting on the freedom of the media. So in other words, what media writing is what media writing. And of course, bringing those information to the school does require an intermediary at the school to be able to go and screen certain bit of information to go and say, is it appropriate or not. It also depends what grade you are in school, where certain information is being introduced. So obviously, as one goes along, we would go look at the criteria of acceptability and be able to go and fine-tune the system to go and make sure that that we only deliver what we are supposed to go and deliver to the individual people.
We live in a very small world. I sat next to Ms. Van der Berg last night in the aeroplane, so I guess I have more background on SA Media than the rest of the committee members. But I would like to know what the cost of a subscription is, and is it the same for an individual person as opposed to schools? And also, she mentioned that magazines are also included. Which magazines, and is there a list of all the newspapers and magazines available on your system?
Thank you. I'll answer the question on the publications that we do, and Vadim will answer on the pricing. So, yes, there is a specific list that we have of all our publications, current publications and past publications that we have on our system. Basically, the newspaper, the magazines that we have on this stage are financial magazines and not the popular like Kaisernet and that sort of stuff. We don't do that, but it's basically financial magazines. And then we've got the teacher as well and that sort of articles, magazines that we have. But we are more willing than people come to us sometimes and say, okay, we need this publication. Can you get that for us? And then we do ask permission and we put it on our system as well. So that's not a problem to get hold of anything that they perhaps will want on our system. So that's not a problem.
To answer your second question about the pricing, we've got a whole range of ways we're setting this thing up. We've got various options in terms of the corporate access, because we do have corporate organizations that are buying into this, as well as universities. And there's also possibilities of having kind of a open-ended access, in other words, unlimited downloads, as many keywords as possible. And then there's options of saying we're only interested in certain topics or we're only interested in certain numbers. Because SA Media is originating and still grounded at the university environment, was always geared towards the educational system. Until now, the majority of clients are with universities, and the services being made available to the tertiary institutions, their libraries for the people. So we have got a scaling way of costing, where we are looking at what is it that, you know, people can go and contribute. So the corporates get asked a little bit more, and individuals, depending on their searches, considerably less to marginal cost. So all of this is essentially being made so that we can go and have a greater footprint of people that can actually go and access the system.
So in a nutshell, what you're inviting the Department of Education, Basic Education, to do is come and negotiate?
Well, again, we have to go and say what is possible. We know that there's 27,000 schools. We know not all schools perhaps are going to be interested. Some of them are more ready than others. Perhaps some provinces first and others. There's a certain amount of participation need in order to go and have certain costs covered, but the more, the less it becomes for the individual one. And we've looked at various models where we can even go and offer something like R1 per day per school to be able to go and see what it actually does. So the scalability makes a great impact, and the affordability is another one. For us, as I said, it is, you know, essentially, you know, widening the access to the media. We also represent the University of the Free State, and obviously University of the Free State, you know, through this also has got access to promoting itself as a institution to the future students of tomorrow. So it's a joint initiative where we would be definitely would like to go and have input and ideas from those who would be involved in such a project.
Well, maybe you want to give us some insight into existing subscription costs so that we have some idea.
To give an indication, corporates, for instance, are paying in the excess of about R150,000 a year. And some of the tertiary university institutions are paying, depending on size and access, between R50,000 to R100,000 a year. And we've got individuals that are paying a couple of R100 excess a year. So individuals that are doing this for their PhD, you know, perhaps paying R500 for that access. It depends on what is possible, what is the availability, and what is the usage. So we also have to go and look what volumes of information is being downloaded.
Well, I have often had to use SA Media through the Library of Parliament, and I know it's enormously useful. So I do want to take the opportunity, in the absence of any other questions from members, for Mr. Hadebe, you want to ask a question?
Thank you, Chief. Mine was to, I understand the concept that is appealing to a certain category of students. Mine was to check your stretching in terms of reaching the rural areas, ensure that it is stretching there. But also, I just want to get what kind of response do you get, what kind of feedback do you get from those who interact with you through the SA Media? Are you getting any improvement? Are you getting any positive appeal in terms of what is it giving?
I'm going to ask a part of the question. We are not infrastructure providers or an IT company, so we have an informational database. So the access to the areas is a little bit out of our own hands, because there's nothing that we can go into for some of those areas to go and have the access. What we do say is that if there is at the school an internet access, people have got the possibility of accessing that information. If there is none, then people can go and call the organization, request the information that they want, for instance, saying next week Monday we've got a class project on giraffes and animals. And then SA Media can go and put together a pack of relevant information and have it sent through available means to the SA Post Office or any other channels that are potentially available. So we can't, in fact, you know, do anything more to infrastructure. I think this is something that, you know, other departments are looking at, but we can go and make it available. In terms of the responses that we have, one of the things that we are tracking for SA Media is how it's been used. And we find almost 3 or 4 times more people that are using that information for anything from bachelor to honors to masters and PhD degrees. So we find the references to that information being available or where it has achieved. We also find in many of corporate policies, when companies are doing, for instance, sustainability reports, we find that they're using that system, they're using the information that has been available. So we do get quite a lot of feedback in terms of that one, but we also have to admit, and it's perhaps a fault on our side, that we've been relatively quiet about what it is that we're actually doing. We're only now starting to go and actually show to the countries and organizations what kind of an asset we in fact have that available. Perhaps that is due to the fact that we're largely an academic organization, and sometimes, you know, we're not the best perhaps to promote our own advantages.
What I can say about schools is the schools in Bloemfontein readily use us because we are in the vicinity, so it's easy for them to get access. And one and all of them says they can't do without SA Media. even the universities, they absolutely, when a student learn of SA Media, sometimes they come a student with 30 or something because we are at the university itself and say, why haven't I heard from SA Media when I was at school? So it's really a national asset to have SA Media available to everybody, because we've got all the news, main newspapers and that sort of stuff, so people can just connect one, to one institution and get all the information that they like. Thank you very much, and thanks for traveling all the way out to Cape Town today, and we wish you a good journey back. Could we get the Pestalozzi Trust to set up, please? You don't have a presentation, sir?
No, we don't have a...
We've got a hard copy.
That's great.
Okay. You have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the honourable members of the committee, for this opportunity. We made a submission on the issue of access to education, and specifically around the issue of access to non-institutional education. We thought it a good idea to establish for our presentation a definition of what we see as education, and we described it as creating conditions that empower learners to develop their inherent potential to the maximum, to the benefit of the individual, the community, and the society at large. Now, having defined what we mean by education, I can just introduce the Pestalozzi Trust. It operates a legal defense fund for home education, as well as a free public information service on home education and other forms of non-institutional education. My name is Leander van Wistrom. I am the executive officer of the Pestalozzi Trust. I did my master's thesis in education on the topic of home education, which is one form of non-institutional education. I have brought along with me two fellow co-presenters, Mr. Simon Humans on my right, and next to me, Ms. Cornelia van Wistrom. 15 years ago was the last time I had the opportunity of addressing this committee, and that was to ask for them to make provision in the SA Schools Act for non-institutional education. Ms. van Wistrom was in the audience then, and she was 7 years old. I brought her along because she has never been to school. Mr. Humans went to school for 2 years, grades 1 and 2. They were both home educated by their parents in their own homes as prescribed by the SA Schools Act. By totally different processes. Mr. Humans' parents used a very systematic approach to education, which consisted of a highly structured learning program with structured learning materials and so on and so forth. Ms. van Wistrom, on the contrary, had, except in mathematics, the first time in her life that she ever had a textbook was in any of her subjects was in her matric year. The first time in her life that she ever wrote school-type tests or examinations was in her matric year. And she passed her matric, all her subjects at higher grade with an aggregate A. So I am presenting you two examples of young people who have been educated by means of non-institutional education. They are both at university now. also never went to school. But of course, we have many examples like that in history. President Kruger of the Transvaal Republic went to school for about 2 weeks and yet became an internationally known statesman. He was also a theologian of note, and there are people who are writing doctoral theses about his theology. Next week, it will be 100 years since Louis Botha became the first Prime Minister of the Union of South Africa. He went to school for 2 years. General Smuts first went to school at the age of 12 and then finished his matric in 2 years and went on to become one of the top law students at Cambridge University in the 19th century. My own mother was educated at home through primary school and became a medical doctor. So that is why we feel that it's very important to have an accurate definition of education, because the idea seems to have developed that education can only happen in schools. That is an idea that has taken root only since in the past 100 years, and yet education happens everywhere and happens in many ways. And in a time when our schools are in crisis, I think it is necessary that we look at other ways as well. Now, as I've said in the a written presentation, it is not only South African schools that are in crisis. It is around the world. If you do a bit of a search in the media of developed countries, the term crisis in education pops up on a very regular basis. And it's not a new thing either. In the 1970s, the United States became very concerned about their crisis in education, and President Carter instituted a research committee which reported eventually to President Reagan, and it was a very big report, of course, so they summarized it in what they call a letter to the American people, which they gave the name Nation at Risk. And the conclusion of that report was that if the conditions in the American education system had been the result of action by a foreign country, it would have to be considered an act of war. The point being that by 1984, the Americans were very concerned about what was happening in the education, and they started research to find a better way. And the result of their research was the so-called OBE system, which they implemented in a project called Curriculum 2000, with the idea that by the year 2000, the system would be implemented throughout and the crisis in education would be solved. It didn't work. As they started implementing the OBE system, they also started phasing it out. The result was that in the year 2000, when it was supposed to be fully implemented, it was actually defunded by Congress. Now, what happened was other countries have this, as I've said, the same problem. And one country after the other implemented OBE, and one country after the other phased it out. And it seems as if we're doing the same thing as well. So school education as a whole definitely has a problem. School education as we know it, there have always been schools, but the way that school education as we know it is a structure that was developed primarily for the industrial societies in the 19th and 20th centuries. And it seems as if the system, the way we're running it, is not capable of dealing with the problems of the 21st century. The information era, the postmodern. we believe that one of the problems is that if we operate from the assumption that education only happens in schools, what we're actually doing is we're cutting off access to non-institutional education in many ways. One, for example, is we keep people in schools where, according to many people, they're not learning, while they could be learning elsewhere. Advocate Hoffman of the Institute for Accountability, for example, says that many of our schools are in fact nothing other than child mining services. So in that way, school attendance in some ways, in actual fact, closes off possibilities of access to other forms of education. But there are other ways as well in which our assumption that education only happens in schools gives us problems. The new matric system and the phasing out of the N1 to N3 technical training system has effectively cut off all possibilities of obtaining qualifications for millions of adults and other persons who don't have access to school education. I spoke to the manager of Intech College earlier today, and he confirms that Intech had in 2006, the last year we had the old matric system, in 2006 they had 12,000 matric candidates. The next year they had none. The year after, when they started implementing the new National Senior Certificate as a possibility, they had 80 students. This year they have 400. And they don't see it growing much beyond the 400 because the new system simply is not suitable for part-time and private candidates to be examined. Of course, the many thousands of people who educated themselves through the N1 to N3 system have no longer have that access at all. But there are other people as well. Many young children cannot attend school. We have, for example, many families who are homeschooling AIDS orphans whom they have in foster care. And I'm going to ask Mr. Humans to give there, as an example, a project by the Catholic Church where they are educating almost 300 AIDS orphans because it's not possible for them to go to school.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. There's a number of years ago, a lady named Bev Olbers established what is now known as the Mother of Peace Communities, starting first in Zimbabwe and has now established two communities in South Africa. In the communities, they look after AIDS babies, children that have been abandoned, and from the babies up to older ages, and are brought up by the staff working there. In many of these cases, children, as they reach school-going age, are either too ill or disabled in some way, preventing them from entering the normal schooling system. Currently, this community in Zimbabwe homeschools young children up to grade 4, but are currently working on providing more facilities to extend the length of time of education. In addition, some of the children they take in are over the normal school-going age, and to prevent them from being put with children younger than themselves, they educate the children separately and thus bring them up to standard to their peers so that they can have education along with their peers rather than disabling them. In addition, after being abandoned, some of the children are emotionally scarred and are not ready to enter normal society, and so are homeschooled, or these emotional scars are healed, and schooling enables them to enter normal society again at the same level as their peers.
Thank you very much for your input. Mr. Pestalozzi, I just wanted to... That's your trust name.
Von Wistrom is the name.
Is that right, Wistrom?
Von Wistrom.
Von Wistrom.
That's correct.
It's double O, not double O-E.
Double O, yes.
Double O. Can I just find out, in your submission, what I was hoping you would speak about some more is this notion that you put forward about reducing the access to matric. And can I just ask you, perhaps, before we start engaging, to just develop that argument a little bit more for me. You raise the N1 to N3 issue, but in your submission you say very starkly that previously, it was easy for learners who were not in an institution to access the matric exam. Now it isn't. Could you explain what you mean by that, maybe with further detail?
Yes, ma'am. There are two ways in which it has become more difficult. The one is simply it has become incredibly expensive because under the old system, anybody off the street could go and write a matric exam. All you had to do was register yourself with one of the provincial or private examination boards, prepare yourself for the examination by whatever means you preferred, and go and do the exam. And many people were able to do that very cheaply, at R1,000 or less, if you used second hand textbooks and so on and so forth. With the new system, you cannot do the matric exam unless you have been registered with an accredited institution for 3 years. And the state does not provide such opportunities. In fact, the Western Cape Education Department closed the school in Mitchell's Plain, which was providing for or Kailicha, I'm not sure, somewhere there, which was providing for students, for part-time and private candidates. So the only ones that are available are private institutions, and these come at a price. To do matric costs you at least R10,000 a year with those private institutions. I think INTEC is now coming in at a bit lower than that, but on the whole, it means that it costs you about R30,000 to get a matric if you're not in a school. Of course, that's what it costs the state to put somebody through matric as well. So the one aspect is the aspect of the cost. The other one is the examination, the examination method is designed for institutional education, which makes it almost impossible and very expensive for private and part-time candidates to be examined in that way. They have to be placed under supervision and travel to specific locations to be examined at certain intervals and so on and so forth. On the whole, the examination method that comes with the National Senior Certificate is a far more expensive approach than the previous one was, of course. But if you see what's happened among adult learners, And everybody else who used to do the matric through correspondence and that sort of thing, most of those people are now going for the British Cambridge qualification as the only workable, really workable option that's left to them.
And what is
that? I hope I answered your question.
Well, I'm more trying to understand, because from what you're telling me, it's actually the attachment to an institution that costs that prohibitive amount. Because you say public institutions, public schools, for example, won't take part-time students, right? And so they're forced to go to private institutions, which cost a whole lot more.
That's great.
So that's your cost factor. But then you're saying when it comes to, for example, assessments of projects and so on, that also limits the possibility of somebody being homeschooled, for example, because you have to be assessed by a teacher as part of your overall results at the end of the year kind of thing for the projects that you would have submitted in the year, which again forces institutionalized kind of learning. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, ma'am. This is what INTEC, for example, finds is a major problem for them. It means that an organization like that actually has to provide infrastructure for those kinds of assessments and so on and so forth. And they serve people all over the country in small areas, small communities, distant communities, and so on and so forth. And it becomes very difficult and therefore very expensive for them to provide services like that. They're not the only ones who do it. There are other organizations as well. But it's also very difficult for the student. In effect, it means an adult learner of 30 years old would have been able in the past to do matric in about 2 years through correspondence. Now, INTEC tells me that it takes them roughly 6 years with the new system, and that means that many adult learners simply don't see 6 years worth of hard work as being worth the result that they're getting out of it, and they simply give up or just don't start in the, with their matric at all.
I'm a bit confused. Just explain to me the INTEC stuff, the schooling through INTEC, which is your correspondence, which is what you refer to as correspondence schooling. Does homeschooling is that the same thing? Do many parents who are homeschooling their kids make use of this kind of format, or is homeschooling something completely different?
No, almost all homeschoolers who do a South African matric do so through one of the organisations such as INTEC. There are other organisations which also provide support for home education at lower grade as well as through matric. There we're talking about organizations such as Brainline, Delta Education, TCE, and so on and so forth. But many homeschoolers did their matric through INTEC or Damlin or one of those as well. So it's very much the same, although INTEC will tell you that great majority of their clients have always been adults and not children or young people, in other words, homeschooled ones.
And how would the homeschooled kids actually do the matric?
In exactly the same way. Through
INTEC and so on.
Through INTEC or one of those. At the moment, the organization that has most matric candidates coming specifically from the homeschooling community is an organization education called Mpak Onderwijs, alternatively Delta Education, which is the English language version. They write the matric of the Independent Afrikaans Examination Board, and in last year's matric, two of the three top students who wrote that exam, and all the other students, the students who are not homeschooled students, are all private school students. But two of the top three students were home learners in their exam.
And how many learners are we talking about in South Africa? Kind of ballpark.
Well, as we say, we had, as far as adult learners are concerned, going for matric, in 2006, Intech alone had about 12,000. In home education, currently we're getting about 1,000 matrics per year. The total number of home learners, nobody knows how many there are. I have about 9,000 on my books. I estimate that the minimum number that there probably are in the country would be in the region of about 30,000. The real figure could be over 100,000.
And that's primary as well as high school, 30,000?
That's primary as well as high school, ma'am.
Can I also just ask you, when you raise these two prohibitive factors, the institutionalization, basically, of schooling as opposed to a non-institutionalized kind of system, what, and you're saying to me that really what is happening is because of the design of the curriculum, people are forced to use institutions and therefore it drives the cost up. And you're saying, as opposed to what happened in the past, which is a rather freer system, where all you needed was the standard schooling material, and then you could just go and register and write the exam, which allowed for freer access and, of course, cheaper access and so on. That has been dealt a death blow simply because of the curriculum.
That is, and specifically the assessment method that is used in the new curriculum, which in fact mixes summative assessment with formative assessment, and therefore makes the assessment process a long period of observation, which makes it also in public schools and private schools, in institutions themselves, it makes the assessment system far more expensive. Ask the teachers who have to do all those assessments. They work very hard at it. And what is actually happening is the teachers are paying the price for a more expensive assessment method.
Well, one of the things, of course, that the department is busy with is a review of the curriculum. And part of that is also reducing the number of aspects to be assessed. But that's not completely eradicating projects and so on. And that's not going to help you too much, because that still allows for a system of assessment. Whether it's 50 or whether it's 5, there's still a process that needs to happen, and that's not going to deal with your problem. Have you thought about, within the framework, I mean, clearly the department's not going to change the curriculum to such an extent as to eradicate all other methods of assessment, simply to accommodate 1,000 students who happen to be homeschooled. But at the same time, I don't think the department will be unsympathetic to people who do wish to homeschool their kids and so on, and to ensure that as much flexibility as possible. thought about sustainable recommendations going forward?
We were hoping that something would come out of the new adult matric. Just to correct you on the department being sympathetic, I sat in a meeting with Brainline a few months ago where they were simply told by the provincial education department that they were talking to that as far as the department is concerned, they should close down because the department wants all children in schools. There's not widespread sympathy, if I can put it that way. We were hoping that the new adult matric that is being proposed would alleviate some of these problems. But now I've been speaking to the people at the department and at Umaluzi who are working on this. Nobody seems to know really. Umaluzi tells me 2011 this examination will be able, should be available, but in practice we can get no information about how it will work and so on and so forth. I'm told that from the education department, our national education department side, that they've actually put it on ice. So we don't really know what to expect from that quarter.
Okay, let me just ask one final question here, because it seems to me that if we're wanting access, and if we're going to have the kind of situation that pertains particularly around orphans and people who are not able to access schools because of the remoteness of where they live and so on, that this becomes quite an important debate. But at the same time, you see, the one difficulty that I have, and let me just be upfront with you here, is the approach. Because on the one hand, you know, it doesn't help to say schools are dysfunctional, they don't work, and so on, and that homeschooling is, or should we say institutionless schooling is the way to go, and then find your solutions in that, because that's not going to happen. That's pie in the sky. My own parents would not have been able to homeschool me because they didn't go past their primary school, okay? So in this country, the reality is institutionalization of education is going to continue, right? But having said that, certainly my view, and I'm sure most of the portfolio committee's view, would be that one, and that's the reason why we spoke in the theme of these hearings about access, and that is opening up access where access is difficult currently with the institutionalized form, which is really your mainstream schooling. Now, if we are going to have a proper debate around access, it seems to me that one of the things that we should be talking about is the flexibility of the system. And if the system itself is inflexible, then you're not going to allow for greater access. And that's really the bottom line. And it's there where I see a paucity of ideas. Not just necessarily from the department, because the department basically will be more concerned with getting the schools to function. You yourself said the department is very concerned about how our schools are doing and so on. So it's going to spend less energy trying to devise solutions and think about possibilities within the existing system, because it can't be that the solution lies in a stark, well, let's get rid of institutions. That's not going to happen. So what we need to do is we need to say, well, there's the institution. Why can't, for example, a public school, if we're going to reduce the areas of assessment to, let's say, 5 or 10 assessment areas, why is it that we can't rope in public schools to assist with home-based schooling or the kind of institutions that the young man is speaking about there in order to just assist with the assessments and so on, to have some kind of profile on those learners? but that they need to be, you know, unless, and maybe I'm reading you wrong, unless there's some kind of absolute philosophical stance against having anything to do with institutions.
No, ma'am. I think we also put it in our written submission that we're always going to have institutionalized education, and probably for the great majority of the people in society. The institutions are going to have to change if they're going to need to meet the needs. They can't carry on the way they do. But we're always also going to have a need for non-institutionalized
sure.
education. And I'm not talking about 1,000 homeschooled children every year writing the trick. We're talking about 12,000 adults who are not writing the trick because they can't anymore every year. Honestly, I'm not sure that we can afford in our society to waste that motivation, that commitment, and so on. So yes, I think I must make it very sure, very clear that there is no philosophical or a radical opposition to institutions as in themselves. They never can be.
We'll certainly follow up the issue of the adult matric that you spoke to. I see Ms. Njobe is shaking her head, I suppose, because you don't have any further information, Ms. Njobe, Ms. Chobeka, about the adult matric design with Uma Lucy and so on. But we'll get some information about that, and we'll certainly put it before the portfolio committee when we relook the submissions. Okay. I saw a few hands here. How are you? Very well, thank you. I'll give you the first opportunity. I've got Ms. Mishwana, Mr. Is there anybody between? Okay. Yes, sir. Okay, let's give you numbers 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity after you engaged each other for quite a long time while we're waiting. Chairperson, I'll start with the terminology itself, non-institutional education. Really, it has provoked me to participate in this debate. Chairperson, what I want to say on this sector is that you can't separate education and the institution. And I challenge whoever on this sector. Because whenever you talk about education, the institution is next to that education. They are married, and you can't really divorce the two. I challenge whoever wants to debate on this call. Unless we say maybe we talk about a daily non-attendance. Then the daily attendance. Maybe we say the non-attendance of the institution. But the institution with education, you can't separate the two. I challenge whoever on this sector. Chairperson, as I listen very carefully, to the present is encouraging or emphasizing the fact that people are getting certificates when they learn private. In fact, even if they learn privately or part-time. But I should think in that score there are programs that are supporting a person who's learning private or part-time. Can he elaborate further on the problem that they have in their institution? Because in the department we do have a program of how do we educate our learners in our institutions. But in their institutions, if maybe they come about a program of people can learn privately, maybe you can go to school for grade 1 up to 4 from there, then you can go for part-time. Can we just get information about their program? Then
myself, I would really
our current education system is one of the good and the best that we have in Africa. And I don't believe it's at any time that any person can come and rubbish this current system that we have, education that we have. It really, I really can't see any person come with some kind of a debate. When Cyril speech is fine, but it's a fact. Mine, you know, I usually see this private education system or associated with a system that takes one's individual, isolating that person away from social life. I don't know, my experience, people that went into that private schooling system, when you meet them, they can't even associate themselves with the general knowledge of outside, because their focus is systematical and stereotype of what they know from private schooling system. I really want to get an understanding in terms of your, what is the main vision of your organization? Because maybe our understanding might be a little bit lower, because we haven't been able to, you know, give us that preview in terms of intellectual sense. What do you want to see at the end? What is your ultimate goal in terms of this? The systems that you're coming with. The other question is that then how do you standardize your learners? How do you suddenly just arrive at a certain day and say, no, this one can write my trick now? How did you structure? How did you standardize? How did you qualify? How did you assess this person? How did you qualify this person that can be able to go up to that level? Because it's one of the other things that, you know, we believe that in our education system, you know, it's systematic, it's standardized, you know. I was just asking the madam there, when I was placing this thing, I was like, hey, you know, one hasn't got this opportunity to learn all those things. But if one can be able to, you know, a young brain child, you know, that is groomed under these systems growing up, can be able to tell you more about things that you can be able to learn. That's what I'm trying to get. How do you, at a certain stage, then say, this person can be able to qualify to be there.
Okay, and lastly, Mr. Michael Bela, please, rather quickly.
Sure, thanks. I think I'm not raising a lot of things. My take is that the law in South Africa allows for both formal and informal, and you can ultimately, if you think the child is well prepared, regardless of what is the stream from which this person comes from, you can then subject those to grade 12 exam. So there's no, I think in that regard, there's no difference. And I would want to believe that it's as progressive, because we're not banning private learning and so on. You'll be coming broader in understanding that you can. But to me, private education in South Africa will be more afforded by the rich. So it will be very difficult to see a working class kind of family who can educate their own and hope that this particular individual can at some point sit for metric. It's very good. Yes, this person can have some life skills, but it can't be as academic as we're doing now. So I thought your recommendation in the main is just to ensure that particularly the NCV, which I thought you emphasized on, and that it's limiting to some degree, and even the outcry that it's even causing people to fail and so on, and adding more work onto the students. I think that to me is an issue. But when the government shifted to that, I think there was motivation to saying, why should we do away with N1 and 2 and 3 and so on. It was after thorough analysis of the programs. Now, your trust and the other persons, academics and so on, are saying perhaps it may not be a good move. We will continue to assess and see whether there's need to do some reversal or to move to introduce both and so on. So some will say we can't do languages and so on and so on. We just wanted to do artisan kind of trades, and we are able to do and earn a living. And when today you still subject them to languages and so on, and so on, which they continue to face, you know, that kind of thing. So it's something that with experience we can be able to say, but perhaps we're not, the program is not producing the desired goals and so on and so on. I think to that degree, I may be agreeable to your proposal. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. I hope that I've understood the questions clearly. What I'm going to do is, if you don't mind, I'm not going to answer them in the sequence that they came, because I think I can combine some of the things. I'm going to ask for just quickly to it was Mr. Khadebe who is very concerned about the issue of isolating people in home education. I'm going to ask Ms. van Oostrom to respond to that, if you don't mind.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Is that the question about socialization and isolation. And I think we should think carefully of what do we mean by socialization? What is the point of socialization? Now, as I see it, socialization is your interaction with other people, getting along with them, actually being able to function in the world after school, you know, being able to get along with other people. And I believe that a family is a much better example of a social group than what a class at school is. Because if you think of any workplace, how often do you find a group of 30 people of the same age and the same cultural and social background doing the same thing at the same time? You know, it doesn't often happen. And usually in the workplace, it is people of different backgrounds, different ages, who are working together to make a project happen, which I think is, we can find a perfect example in a household. People also always ask the question of, you know, where do you get friends? Because it's you know, it's the same thing that they think you grow up very, very isolated. And I believe that one needs to work maybe harder on your social skills. Because in school, you have a whole group of, say, 8-year-olds around you, and you fight with this little friend, so you turn around and you'll be friends with that one tomorrow, and tomorrow you fight with that one, and you move on. In home education, you actually have to work on building up a friendship and keeping that friendship. You can't just throw away someone if you get tired of them.
Thank you. As far as the first questioner was concerned about programs, and Madam Chair asked that we say something about the trust. The Bestfalty Trust does not offer any education at all. What we do is to promote an environment in which people are free to do non-institutional education by, for example, working towards better laws and policies, by getting engaged in law cases where it's necessary, and so on and so forth. That's our job. But there are numerous ways of educating children at home. An example of a program I bought this last week, grade 3, at CMS. is designed and written as an augmentation for school education. But in fact, it turns out that it is so comprehensive that children who have worked through this program perform better than those who are attending schools. And that's the entire grade three. Now, this is one example. You get very, very expensive online, internet-driven courses that can cost you, as I say, 7,000 to 10,000 rand a year. But you don't need any of that at all. The surprising thing is that a lot of the time children teach themselves. And there's a whole movement within home education, which is known as the unschooling movement. I'm not very fond of that name. But the point is that when you test the children, irrespective of which kind of approach they use, when they test it by means of standardized tests, they tend to all perform very much in the same at the same level. Now, I used to think at the beginning that that means that it doesn't matter what approach you use. What I've discovered since is that what parents actually do is they experiment with different approaches and different ways of educating their children until they find an approach that works for each child and works best for each child, by which time the child has changed and you start all over again. So there are numerous different ways of doing it. Some are commercial programs that you can buy, others the parents design for themselves, etc., etc. I think it was Mr. Macabella was concerned about that this is something for the rich. It is an idea that people have that this is the kind of thing that ladies in Bishop's Court who have nothing else to do with their time do that. In actual fact, a lot of the members of my organization are people who choose home education because it is the only way in which they can afford a good education for their children. In the sense that I had a call yesterday again from a lady in Johannesburg. She simply cannot afford any of the schools that are available to her children. And therefore, she's homeschooling her children because it is affordable. Now, there's been plenty of research. You don't need a high education in order to educate your own children. Children in home education who are educated, even by parents who have not finished their own matric, perform as well, on average, as those whose parents are qualified teachers or who have postgraduate or professional qualifications. And if you look at your poorest families in this country, most of those are the families where parents are unemployed. In other words, they have the time to make themselves available to work with their children and so on and so forth. So I don't think that is a major problem. The second questioner wanted to know how many non-institutionalized learners there are in the country. As I say, nobody knows. We do know that there are, that until 2006, when the old matric system was still available, we had 12,000 adults entering for the matric exam every year. As far as how many would have written matric now if they could, we don't know. As far as children in home education are concerned, also nobody knows how many there are. My own estimate is that there are probably at least in the region of 30,000. The total could be more than 100,000. wonder if Mr. Humans would comment on the issue of institutionalization or whether education and institutions are inseparable.
Just on the quick on institutional education, institutions are needed to get recognition for your education, because people in the working place want a piece of paper that they can see. But education happens all the time. There's a saying that you learn something new every day. So you don't necessarily need the institution itself. In my case, I effectively, after about grade 10, I taught myself. I had books, I had the materials given by the supplier, and that was all I needed. I did not need a curriculum.
I think I can. The last question was, what was the matric pass rate? That was the third questioner. We don't know again, because home learners write through many different channels. But I have one example which we could probably generalize. The Independent Afrikaans Examination Board last year and the year before last had on average about 300 home learners writing there, a little bit more than the number of private school learners that were writing that exam. And the pass rate was for the private school candidates as well as the home learners was exactly the same. It was 92%. The only difference was that the average number of distinctions per candidate amongst the home learners was 50% more than amongst the private school learners. Thank you, ma'am. I hope I have addressed all the questions. If I've missed one, can you please correct me?
I'm afraid I don't have time to correct you, because I'm getting glares from other people who are obviously also going to be missing their planes, and I'm told that you are having to rush to the airport in case you've forgotten about that. But thank you very much. I think in a nutshell, your message is quite clear, that when we talk about access, we're not talking about access to schooling, we're talking about access to education first and foremost, and I think that we are all sometimes very guilty of conflating the two. And it's always good to bear in mind that education is more than just schooling. Thank you very, very much to all of you, and we wish you a pleasant trip. We will, as I say, deal with the one issue that you raised on the matter of the adult matric exam, Mr. Van Oostrom.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you for your opportunity.
Thank you very much. Can we get MindLab? Who's here from MindLab? Ms. Charles. Welcome, Ms. Charles. Are you all set up?
Yes.
Oh, good. Could we give you 10 minutes?
Yes. Good afternoon to Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much again for the opportunity to showcase the MindLab program. I do realize we bit out of time, so I'm going to go as fast as I can. Just briefly, what I'd like to cover is what the program is about, just some background in terms of theories, the goals of the program, the application, as well as just a brief example of the South African context and just what my proposal would be. In terms of where the program originates from and what it's about, it's developed in Israel in 1994. And where it is currently part of the school curriculum. It's in operation in 25 other countries around the world, and I had the opportunity to become the first person to obtain the program for South Africa. There is obviously a lot of research and theory that has gone into the foundations of this program, most notably by Professor Donald Green of Yale University. Basically, the program is aimed at children between the ages of 5 and 16 in most countries. Obviously, it's got to be country-specific. In our country, in fact, in the UK and Israel, it's 4 to, 14. And for our context, it might be a little bit older and might, you know, bump it up by a year, 5 to about 16. There is a complete package. It's a curriculum that is complete, and it would cover up to, you know, up to about 30 lessons, which means, you know, you could have a complete year out of that program. There are different steps in terms of being age-specific. There's a program specifically for your kindergarten or your preschoolers, so from your age 5, 6, and 7, that being, you know, our equivalent of foundation, and then intermediate and right up to, I would say, even the, I think it's seniors, yeah. The main tool of this program is games, and as you can see on the table, that's what I've put out there. It's basically using games as a powerful educational tool. There's a lot of, you know, instances where it is already being used, but it's obviously not formalized. But just the way that games present themselves, that is what children can relate to, and that is what, you know, presents in their world something that they can look at as fun, but at the same time that they can learn from. And just the authenticity of playing a game. If I had to draw a circle and put the word game in there and ask you for things that come to mind immediately, it'll be things like competition or winning, losing, you know, rules, that kind of thing. And if I had to take that away and put life in there, it translates very well that games present us with the same kind of opportunities or the same kind of scenarios and emotions, and that kind of, you know, dealing with different aspects of a game would be the same as what you would encounter in real life. And that is the authenticity of just of games. Just some background, I'm going to go briefly. Some of the theories or educational theories that are espoused and that form the basis of the MindLab program is one of the constructivist theories of John Dewey, who is an American philosopher and educationalist, where he espoused that children should be at the center of the learning process. And I think that also just comes in, you know, in line with what the objectives are of the curriculum that we currently have. Another one of those is Howard Gardner, where he you know, brought about the theory of multiple intelligences, and we know that everybody has got different, you know, have different talents, and not everybody is academic. So you've got, you know, your logical or mathematically inclined people. You've got your kinesthetic or the people that are good in sports and so forth. So everybody develops differently, and all of those intelligences have to be nurtured and have to be brought out. So in that way, we need to be aware of them firstly, and then, you know, encourage children in the way that they, that, you know, where, you know, where their most strongest intelligence or their personal talents lie. David Perkins, he teaches about transference, and I think this is the crux of what this program is about. Basically, taking elements from one area or one field and transferring it and applying it to another. And in the case of the MindLab program, is taking that experience of playing the game and the concepts of what you teach while you're teaching them how to play the game and applying that to real life. That is the beauty, or the I would say the basis or the backbone of what the MindLab program is about. So it's transferring between maybe contents of things that are similar. Like, for example, if you can drive one model of a car, you could easily drive another car. However, you know, making the transference between driving a car and flying an aeroplane, that is what, you know, almost what you could term as distance transference. So there would be some basics that would be the similar, but you'd need to learn and you'd need to apply yourself much more or get more information in order to transfer to maybe flying a plane. So those are the kind of things that need to, you know, that form the basis of what the MindLab program is about. So taking what you're learning in the game situation and then applying it to real life, whether it's doing your homework, whether it's in a social situation. So it's taking those principles and applying them in different learning areas. So does that mean that transference is automatic in learning? So what you learn in your science class is automatically then translated to real life? Because I've often asked myself the question is, you know, when I was at school, why am I learning certain things? And I never quite made the connection between what I was learning at the time and how I would use it when I was out of school. But obviously the connection is there, and that's the reason why you learn certain contents. There's certain basics that you do need to know. However, the application is what needs to be sometimes just emphasized. And that is one of the theories of Professor Feuerstein, where mediated learning is encouraged. And this is to take what you have learnt in one area and actually, as a teacher, you facilitate how that can be applied in different areas. So that is the principle of mediated learning. So that's, you know, all of these things, all of these different theories have been put together as the basis of these programs. Okay. Basically, the goals are to develop the awareness of thinking. They need to know that there is a thinking process, and things don't just learn. It's not just a matter of reading off a page. There is thinking that goes behind how you arrive at certain things, and imparting those different skills in terms of whether they are pure cognitive problem solving, decision making, those kind of things, and then strengthening life skills by the social interaction. A lot of the kids today often, you know, there's lots of technical gadgets, and the social skills are sometimes left behind in that they can be on their cell phones, on you know, different gadgets, and forget and don't know how to communicate or, you know, be able to interpret verbal and nonverbal skills. And also, again, that interpersonal, you know, disciplinary transference, taking what you've learned in one area and transferring it elsewhere. Okay, so how is it applied? Basically, they get taught a game. There's obviously a theme around it. For example, if they're learning problem solving, you would teach them a game that would be appropriate for problem solving. You then teach them a strategy or a thinking concept, one of which, for example, I'll cover later, but is a simple stoplight method, taking red light means stop, take into cognizance what is around me, being aware. Orange would be, now what do I do next? Planning, so getting them to the stage of, I've got to be aware, gather information, plan, and then I act. Because, again, you know, children are impulsive naturally. They just decide, you know, do things without thinking about them. And taking that then in the next part of the lesson would be taking that and now applying. So you're going to discussion about how do you apply that which you've learned now in a different situation. How would you apply that in maths? How would you apply that in English? How would you apply that in the sports field? How would you apply that at home? Okay, just some of the skills that are developed. Again, I'm mentioning the different areas. Cognitively, the pure thinking skills, problem solving, that's just some of them, decision making, drawing conclusions, in terms of social skills, cooperation, learning to read verbal, nonverbal communication, teamwork. And also there's rules. In everything and in life there's rules that apply and there's structure. As far as emotional skills, not, you know, for 1 minute expecting teachers to become psychologists, but how do they manage their emotions? Games provide that opportunity for them to be able to actually deal with winning and losing, how to defer gratification, how to actually learn from their mistakes, and, you know, not to repeat those actions or to repeat the good actions. Okay, just some of the games in terms of problem solving would be, I've got just some of them here. Some of you might be familiar with them. Some of them are, a lot of these games you'll see come from different parts of the world, and there are some African games as well. Everybody knows checkers. There is the one on the top, I think that's traditionally you dig holes in the ground, but they've obviously made it into a game. That's helping with planning and sequencing, information analysis, getting information. There is just so much information out there in this day and age. But how do you actually analyze that information and only use what is relevant to them at the time? Resource management. again, you know, these are some of the things that can be actually used within families during, you know, family time. I know, you know, most parents work, they have, you know, both parents work, but this is obviously something that can also strengthen family relationships where you sit around a table and you play these games, and that is how parents would get involved. Okay, as I mentioned, this is just one of the thinking concepts behind the Mind Lab method, which they would need to then apply. They could apply this then to the game, they could apply it in any situation and in other learning areas as well. In terms of just the networks of how all of this interlinks, so they could learn a concept which could be applied to different games and the different thinking concepts that would again be applied to more than one situation. So there is this constant learning and application to the various learning areas and applications in different social situations as well. Okay, in terms of a South African model, as this is, you know, the first time that I've implemented, as I mentioned before in my submission, is that I'm not an educator myself, but a parent that came across this program. I've only been able to pilot this in one school in Johannesburg so far. Basically, a lot of the objections or the gaps that I found is that in terms of obviously there's it's not part of the curriculum, so there's obviously not time that has been set aside to actually implement something like this, and also the costs, as well as obviously they need, you know, there's a specific curriculum and content that, you know, the teachers need to get through. But this particular school, obviously a lot of private schools are in a better position or to actually implement different programs. And in this case, this is a private school where they have, you know, taken on the program. Again, there's different options and there's different ways in which this is applied. I have come across schools, some public schools, where they have, in certain learning areas, where they have applied certain a similar concept, but obviously not a full-on or fully-fledged, program like this. But they have, introduced games as part of their lessons. Basically, how this would work is there's obviously, you know, depending on what the school, you know, has access to, they can either have a Mind Lab facilitated approach where we would run the program, or they could get a site license where the school would then, you know, get a license where they get the teachers trained. They could get the material depending on how many classes and how long they would want it to be run for, and then obviously support so that it doesn't become this white elephant that purchased the stuff and it sits in a cupboard somewhere and it's not actually implemented.
Thank you very much, Ms. Charles. I want to suggest that perhaps you hang around a bit later, seeing as you've brought all of your model toys and sound members. I'm sure would want to ask you specific questions around how to use some of these tools and so on. Any questions, members? Could you hold it until you interact with the toys? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Charles. Thank you very much. It sounds fascinating, and I'm sure members will engage you with a little more specific detail once you are able to demonstrate how to use some of these games. Thank you so much. Mr. Fisser? That's fine. You've had enormous amount of patience with us, so, and thank you for attending the previous sessions. We do have hard copies of your submission as well. Will that just take some time? Do you want to help us with doing that? Well, the physicist can just start with the presentation using the hard copy. should have brought along a textbook, Mr. Fisk.
Good afternoon. Salaam alaikum. Madam Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the honour and opportunity to address this committee. My name is Christian Visser and I represent the Textbook Development Institute. Thank you for your patience, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the limited time available to me, in the limited time available to me, I would like to address the following three questions. How important are textbooks in teaching and learning? Is there a problem with textbooks? And what can we do to improve the quality of textbooks? In my written submission to this committee, I tried to provide argument and evidence to answer this question, how important are textbooks? How important are textbooks? I'm not going to repeat it here. However, allow me to draw your attention to this one quote from the UNESCO publication with the title Textbooks and Quality Learning for All. Textbooks will remain an instrument of extraordinary power, the most effective of educational technologies yet invented, and there is no reason to imagine a modern educational system where textbooks do not play a central role. And it continues to promote quality education for all. There is a need to increase the quality of textbooks. Let me move to the second question. And I would like to spend a little more time on this question. Dr. Linda Sidelum, Special Advisor to the Minister of Education, had this to say about the quality of textbooks. Currently, the quality of textbooks being used in schools is variable as a result of design flaws in Curriculum 2005 and the unreliability of the evaluation process. Linda identified two factors that have had a negative impact on the quality of textbooks. First, the way in which the curriculum was designed, which was the OBE format that caused untold problems for the publishing industry to translate the curriculum into meaningful and teachable content. And secondly, the process of evaluating textbooks. In my written submission, I list five reasons why the evaluations were unreliable. Madam Chair, hardly any research has been done on the quality of textbooks in South Africa. In one research project conducted by Wilkinson in 1999 on the quality of textbooks, the team concluded that many print-based learning resources in fact constitute a stumbling block in the achievement of true academic knowledge, skills, and attitude. So instead of it being a resource, it becomes a barrier to learning. There's research by Tiens Horn A literacy specialist found that textbooks used in schools are often written at the language level well above the ability of students to deal with. Textbooks are often just too difficult for students and maybe also for teachers. Madam Chair, previous submissions to this committee referred to the high dropout rate from our schools. You yourself expressed concern about this. According to UNESCO, international studies on the quality of textbooks repeatedly report that poor instructional design and the reading material that is too difficult or inconsistent have been found to contribute to early dropout in a number of countries. We have a high dropout rate in our schools. How many of those that dropped out, I wonder, dropped out because of the textbooks they were required to work from, books that made no sense to them, books that they just did not understand, and maybe again the teachers did not understand them either. Madam Chair, a factor that is not often considered in the evaluation of textbooks is the language factor. The majority of textbooks are written in the home languages of white students, that is Afrikaans and English. For the majority of black students, education is provided through a language medium that is not their home language, often not even a second language. For them, English and Afrikaans may just as well be a foreign language. Textbooks are written in a language and cultural context that would be familiar for most white learners. For most black learners, however, the language of the textbook is often foreign. I believe the language factor is the major reason for the unequal results between white and black students. In the 206 matric exam, 50% of black students fail, only 4% of the white students fail. And the reason for this inequity in the matric results between white and black students is the language factor. The language of textbooks is aimed at the first language reader. Long sentences, difficult words, absence of context, culturally insensitive, and more. Add to this the level of difficulty of many textbooks that Tiens Horn is talking about, and you have a situation where black students are failing by design. In fact, education in South Africa is set up to fail black students, and this does not apply to schools only. It also applies to colleges and universities. Madam Chair, I'm not suggesting that the solution is mother tongue education. I believe the solution lies in writing textbooks in a language and cultural context that second language learners can deal with. If the textbook is to be in English, then it should use English that is sensitive to the needs of the English second language learner. Shorter sentences, including a glossary of new terms introduced, better definitions, and so on. Madam Chair, I'm currently reviewing a number of textbooks used in schools in teaching mathematical literacy. 32 textbooks for mathematical literacy for grades 10, 11, and 12 were approved by the Department of Education, and this is crazy. In reviewing some of these textbooks, I use an evaluation instrument that I developed and presented at an international conference in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia 3 years ago. I was working in the Middle East as a curriculum development specialist at the time. I could not get a job in South Africa. I was told I was too old. So now I'm reviewing these mathematical literacy textbooks, and at this stage, I'm not impressed. In fact, I'm extremely worried. In whatever way you look at these textbooks, whether from a didactical or pedagogical or language point of view, most of them just don't make the grade. None of the books that I looked at is very good. The best are merely adequate. In the hands of a competent teacher, they could get the job done. But not much more than that. They are poorly structured, explanations are confusing, new concepts and technical terms are introduced without definition, examples are irrelevant, content is boring, and at no stage are students in any way enlightened on why they have to learn the content and how they could apply the content and how they could benefit from mastering the content. Recently, I asked a very competent math teacher which textbook she was using with her matric. She said she's using 5 books because she could not find any one that was good. Now she is picking content from different books. But she has 30 years in teaching, 30 years experience in teaching maths. She knows what to pick and how to use it, and how many teachers like her do we still have around. Madam Chair, on textbook research, I would like to share with you this observation. Most of us are familiar with the Timms and Pearls study. To a certain extent, they reflect a comparison of the effectiveness of the education system of different countries. Pearls, of course, is the progress in international reading, literacy study, and Timms is the trend in international mathematics and science study. And in this regard, South Africa is not doing so well. We are at the bottom of the list in both studies. A question that comes to mind is, what are the countries at the top of the list? What are the countries at the top of the list doing that countries at the bottom of the list are not doing? What is interesting is that countries high up on the Timms and Pearls rating list, countries that are recognized for the quality of the teaching and learning they offer, these countries are all actively involved in textbook research and development. Countries like Singapore, Canada, Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, and so on. In my written submission, I provided the list of some of these organizations involved in textbook research and development. But countries at the bottom of the Timms and Pearls list have limited or mostly no involvement in textbook research and development. This would include countries like South Africa, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait. And despite all the money that these countries have, excluding South Africa, but the oil-rich countries, they are still doing very badly on Timms and Pearls. And part of the reason, I suggest, is because they don't do research on textbook development. Putting simply, countries actively involved in textbook research and development are doing well on Timms and Pearls. It would thus be fair to conclude that a country's involvement in the research on the quality and utilization of textbooks has a significant impact on the quality of teaching and learning in that country. Madam Chair, on the third question, what can we do to improve the quality of textbooks? In my written submission to this committee, I made 16 recommendations, including that a commitment is required to improve the quality of textbooks as a means to improve the quality of teaching and learning. I've also made the recommendation that this committee and the Department of Education support an initiative to establish a textbook development institute. In my written submission, I made 4 recommendations on the role of the Department of Education regarding textbooks. In my supplementary submission, I suggested that those recommendations be replaced by this recommendation, that consideration be given to a ministerial review committee or task team, as it is formulated over here. Madam Chair, I'm going to end my presentation. Coming to the end of my presentation, in this submission, I tried to deal with the following questions. How important are textbooks and learning? Is there a problem with the quality of textbooks? Undoubtedly, yes. What can we do to improve the quality of textbooks? In this regard, I have made 16 recommendations that you have. In conclusion, I believe unless we effectively address the textbook factor as an essential requirement for quality teaching and learning, we will not make any progress in solving this problem. Unless we put a good quality textbook in all subjects in the hands of each and every teacher and learner, we will never achieve good quality teaching and learning in this country. Thank you very much.
Members? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair.
this might be just a comment based on your presentation. I saw something there like textbooks can be a barrier to learning. I don't know how you framed it, but there is something to that effect. My comment is really based on near communication. And this I want to relate to blacks. Personally, in my whole life, I have never seen two white people who are very, very conversant in a foreign language, like maybe an indigenous language, very conversant, especially the farmers. If you go out into the farms, there are white people who speak, you know, very, very fluent indigenous languages. But what I've observed, although I have not been living with them all the time, I don't see them speaking to each other in a foreign language, an indigenous language. If you are African speaking, the moment you realize that the other person is African speaking, you speak Afrikaans, or English, you speak English. Now, I really find it very difficult to say we will reach a stage where we can use a mother tongue as a medium of instruction if we ourselves cannot speak to each other in our own language. Once you are educated, it's like your language becomes inferior. I'm generalizing. I might be wrong. Other people may feel offended by this, but this is just my observation. I have never seen two white. I'm only isolating white people because I know there are quite a number of them on the farms that speak our language very fluently, but they will never. They don't speak to each other. In Sepedi, for an example, once they realize that this man is African speaking, they speak in Afrikaans. But we will speak to one another in English or in Afrikaans as if our language does not exist. So this thing is a problem. And personally, I normally feel like in our schools, we can introduce something like this book, Capitalist Nigger, which I read almost every month. I've read it many times, The Capitalist Nigger. It's a very, very, very wonderful book to me because it tells us, you know, it's a mirror. I think our learners will begin to understand where they are going. It's just a comment. It's just provoked by, you know, your comments on the use of textbooks. And I feel like, will we really reach a stage where we can really produce our own textbooks, even newspapers? I mean, you go to any town, you know, newspapers are either in Afrikaans or in English. You never just get sufficient material in our own language. But we're educated, and we can write, you know, in our own language. But it doesn't happen. So I don't know, there's something wrong somewhere which needs to be vigorously addressed so that we start there with the newspapers, so that people who do not know that high English can read the news in their own language. It's simple. I mean, there are a lot of parents who can read their own language, but they don't have this information. There is something wrong with the educated people. Thank you.
If I can follow up with a question on that note. You mentioned in your submission that you're not promoting mother tongue instruction. What you're saying is that the textbooks should be written in such a way as to synergize with the learners who are using them, in that if it's written in English or in Afrikaans, I take it, and if that is a second language, that the textbook should take cognizance of that and be pitched at the level of a second language speaker and not a mother tongue English or Afrikaans speaker. Why that approach as opposed to textbooks in indigenous languages?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me thank Faisal for presenting such an important information to us. Really, the issue of textbook is a very important issue, and we cannot run away from it at the learning Commission. And he has raised an issue of the black learners who are failing because of not learning with their mother tongue. Now, I just want to ask a question about the textbooks that they are designing. Are those textbooks standardized in such a way that they can accommodate the problem that those black learners are having during the learning? Just one question.
I'm surprised that Mr. Fisser was told that he was too old. He was a curriculum development specialist. Colleagues, have you noticed that Mr. Fisser attended all the submissions as right from the start? So welcome again, and I'm very impressed with what you had submitted to us. You've mentioned the example of the teacher who uses 4 or 5 textbooks in a class because of the poor quality. I used to be a grade 12 teacher for many years, and it's not that I'm opposing what you said, but I made use of at least 5 textbooks for my matric pupils, and the reason was not that they were of poor quality, but textbooks very often complement each other, and it's absolutely to the advantage of the learners that you sometimes make use of 5 or 6 textbooks for a specific grade. Another thing that I just want to mention is if the textbook becomes the main or the most important document in your classroom, the teacher tends to focus on the textbook as if it is the syllabus and ignore the syllabus or the curriculum completely. So that is a danger. Although the textbook is very, very important, it cannot become the curriculum. I would like to ask you, does the Department of Education supply a set of criteria according to which textbooks should be written and also scrutinized eventually? And then just another comment on our current situation of workbooks being written in-house by the department for grade 1 to 6. We have already noticed in the press that we've got a huge reaction from our publishing companies when it comes to in-house documents developed by the department. Thank you.
Just to round off Dr. Kloppers-Lorenz's question about whether there are guidelines from the department, maybe you can give us a sense of what you think makes a good textbook. Slowly, because Mr. Fisser is busy writing down vigorous.
Thank you, Chief Fisser. My question is on the statistics. I just want to check because when I saw the slide there, it was on 2006, if I'm not mistaken, it was 2006 and or 2000. But up to now, I just want to know about is there no improvement up to now? Thank you, Chief Fisser.
Talking about the failure rate.
It was number
45.
Any other questions? The question was why not indigenous language? Why should textbooks not be utilized? Why should indigenous languages not be be encouraged? Madam Chair, my feeling on this is to introduce mother tongue education throughout for all grades, all languages is a long-term process. It's going to take a long time. Professor Sarki Gravitt, in a presentation she made on television a little while ago, she said the immediate solution to the problem that we have with education in South Africa is to improve the textbooks now. So my suggestion is merely that we try and improve what we have in terms of the quality of the textbooks. And it can be done. But mother tongue language is a long-term process. If you can just think how long it took Afrikaans as an indigenous language to develop to become the kind of academic language it is at the moment. It has taken generations to do that. There was the question of the use of 4-5 textbooks and that should in fact be encouraged, and I support that. I'm an ex-accounting teacher and I try to not use other people's textbooks because I've written my own textbooks which I then utilize. But you can get good questions and assessments and concepts from other textbooks as well. So yeah, I think a person that is an expert in the field will probably be using 4-5 textbooks. But the problem is, in this one instance where this lady was saying that she used 4 or 5 textbooks is because she could not find any one that was particularly good. Across the board, for her, the textbooks were not good. And she couldn't, she was probably in a situation where she could not encourage students to use one particular textbook as well. The question on the department guidelines for the development of textbooks, I think our lady from the department would be in a better position to answer that. But I forgot the lady's name. She was head of research at Umaluzi. She has subsequently resigned. But she said she was, before she came to Umaluzi, she was also in the publishing sector. And she said the publishing sector is in chaos because they have different interpretations of the guidelines that is provided by the department. There was a submission made by PASA to the OECD on the publishing industry's perceptions of what was happening in the education system. And there was an example that came out of this report that said different education departments had different take on what a good textbook should look like. The one department, for instance, would approve a textbook with a claim. Another department will then, for the same textbook, not approve it because it does not, according to them, it didn't cover the curriculum. So there was different interpretations on what a good textbook might look like. In the exercise that I'm involved with at the moment, where I'm trying to look at the textbooks for mathematical literacy, it's difficult to think that that the textbooks are using the same curriculum because they are so completely different. If you look at the textbook and the way they deal with the content, you're probably thinking that they are dealing with different curriculum, and yet they are dealing with the same curriculum. Unfortunately, I have no information on the workbooks. I have no idea what is happening with the workbook other than what is in the newspaper. And I'm concerned, again, that maybe there are not clear quality criteria for the workbooks or whatever books that are being developed. The question that you ask, Madam Chair, what makes a good textbook? I have for the last 15 years been concerned with exactly that question, because this is the question that we should be able to answer. I have submitted and I have dealt with this question in a paper at an international conference in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. It is where we try to identify, if I were to pick up a book like this, how would I judge this book to be a quality textbook? What would I be looking at? And we developed an assessment instrument that covers 21 areas and 120 guidelines or pointers that you would look at when you assess a textbook, like evaluate a textbook like this. It covers things like application of adult learning principles or the application of learning principles, the question of the didactics, the question of language. Language is a serious problem. I think I should just refer to this. Horn analyzed a number of learning guides and the written material used with grade 4 pupils in Gauteng. He found that the average readability index, now the readability index is sort of a fogginess index, which tells you how complex the language of that book is. He found that the average readability index for the learning material in technology and economic and business sciences were on a grade 9 level. So you need the reading skills of a person, a student with 9 years of experience, and these books were for grade 4 learners. For the natural sciences, the readability index he found was on a grade 8 level. Some material in natural sciences, learning guide, had a readability index of 15. For grade 4 students, learners, they actually needed 12 years plus a degree in order to read that material. This is crazy. This is ridiculous. And we expose our students to that kind of material. It's not strange that they just drop out of school because they don't know what's going on there. And I wouldn't be surprised if the same applies to the teachers, that the teachers themselves don't know what the textbooks are all about. You were asking about the stats for 2006 or the terms and pearls. What I understand, and I had a look at the statistics again last night on the internet, they haven't changed. We're still last on the list of the countries that are being tested. Our readability in grade 3 is the worst of the countries that took part in the assessment and the evaluation, and the same with mathematical literacy. Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether I answered all the questions.
Now, look, I will offer a few comments now. I think this issue of textbooks, and I think it was Dr. Klopas Lawrence who kind of alluded to it. But in a sense, certainly when I was at school, I got the sense that they wrote the textbooks for the teachers and not necessarily for the learners. And it's almost as if that hasn't changed too much from what you're telling me. If you've got textbooks for grade 4s that are written at grade, what did you say, 15 level or whatever it is, what I'm trying to establish is if we are going to assess a textbook, surely the first and foremost thing has got to be its usability when it comes to learners. I was relating a story to Mr. Mahada and him the other day about how in my matric year, I had no maths teacher. The maths teacher that we had was a physical education teacher who literally would come in and copy what is the examples. You know, in the maths books you get the example, and you copy it on the board, and we're meant to understand it. And were it not for the textbook, I would not have been able to pass my maths. So So for me, that's absolutely crucial. What that is a support for the learning process as opposed to the teaching process. If there are going to be textbooks for teachers, then we should be looking at textbooks for teachers to assist them with different methodologies, different approaches, all of those things. That's fine. But that can't be conflated into the textbook, as it were, for the classroom. And maybe you want to comment about that after I've given other people an opportunity. I see Mr. Khaniach is wanting to add to his earlier statement, and then I've got Ms. Chebeka who wants to quickly also talk to, I think, the Tims and the Pearl.
Yes, I'm just thinking, if the problem is with maybe the level of the language used in a textbook, then obviously we should have a solution to get people who whose level is slightly lower than that one that we are complaining about in the textbooks to write textbooks. That's how I think. What I mean is, obviously, many of the textbooks that we are using in our schools could have been written by, let's take English-speaking people or something of that sort, even if I'm not accurate in that. But obviously, we have also other people, indigenous people, who are educated, who actually, according to me, are not speaking that English to that level of the English spoken by people whose mother tongue is English. Now, those are the people who can write us textbooks that will be at the level of our children. I know that can create a problem when people... You remember in 1956, when Bantu education started, there was a big problem there when people started to speak of Bantu education, which actually literally meant that education is going to be watered down, something of that sort. But the argument here is, The learners do not understand the textbook, like we have been indicating that at times the textbook is written in a language that is actually for a person who has been in school for 9 years or something of that nature to understand what is going on in the textbook. But I don't know, the solution might lie in having the people who speak the same language as the learners writing those textbooks. But now we have another problem, because now we are mixed in schools. Now the question is, would people who speak English, whose mother tongue is English, be happy with, you know, a language that would be seen as watered down, because that element will come in. They would say, now, if the sentences are so short, you know, it becomes very boring and so on. So remember, you are writing for the whole South Africa, not only for one group. So I don't know how this problem can be solved.
Well,
thank
done
you.
With posing the question and answering it.
Thank you, Chair. Just two comments. One is around the latest statistics on Pearls and Tims. Just to recognize that the statistics that are being quoted are the last ones when South Africa participated. The next evaluations are now in 2011. So we'll know whether there's been an improvement when we do the test now in 2011. The other thing is around the criteria for selection of textbooks. They are criteria, but I think the proposals and the presentation comes at a very good time, because as part of the Interministerial Committee on the review of the implementation, there is a task team, there's a subcommittee headed by Gary Rosenberg that looks at the whole area of textbooks and the criteria and how we should manage that. So this can be fed into that process.
Thank you, Ms. Chebeka. Before I give over to Mr. Fisher to give us any last comments, won't you take it upon yourself to just introduce Mr. Fisher to the chairperson of that subcommittee? Okay.
Thank you. May I just comment on the point made by Mrs. Chebeka? Chebeka. Thank you. I think what tends to happen is that when a textbook is evaluated, they tend to look curriculum. They don't look at the other things outside of the content, the curriculum content. And we have, in the process of evaluating these textbooks, for instance, we look at other things other than the content. So we look at the pedagogics, the language, the didactic, and also the effectiveness of information transfer. It was actually important for us in the development of the checklist that we developed that we did not look at the content. That instrument should apply whether you look at the history textbook or whether you look at the biology textbook or a math or mathematical curriculum, mathematical literacy. That those criteria should apply generically for all textbooks. But I think in the evaluation done by the department, they tend to look at the curriculum, to what extent the curriculum has been covered. And an effective textbook is more than just subject content. In terms of the purpose, Madam Chair, I believe there is a place for teacher guide with a textbook, but the textbook is central. It's first of all, it's a learning resource for the pupil, for the student. It's a road map for the teacher. For the principal, it's a tool in his hand to see what is happening in the class. A teacher and a principal doesn't know what's happening in the class. If he's got a quality textbook, and then he can be assured that is what's happening in the class. What is happening in the class is the content of that textbook. For the parents, the textbook becomes their assurance on what their children will learn and be able to do as a result of the education they expect the children to have. For government, the textbook becomes government's assurance that knowledge and skills children are expected to get and have, that which the universal right of every child is contained in the textbook and is provided in the classroom. Textbook is central. And there was this question of the quality, how can we improve the quality. TDI Textbook Development Institute is doing at the moment is we train textbook writers. That's our main business at this point in time. We train textbook writers. We train writers who have been writing textbooks all their lives, and the comment that we have said is, I wish we had been on your course before we started writing the first textbook. So you can improve the quality of textbooks by having an answer to the question that you put originally.
Thank you, Mr. Fisser, for the most enlightening presentation, and I do hope that you will take advantage of meeting with the people in that task team, looking at the review and so on, and give us some feedback, will you? And you've got an open invitation to come back anytime we're having public hearings and call the fort. Thank you for that. And could we have now Ms. Sarah Skeen from the Mental Health and Poverty Project? There's a supplementary document, member. Sure. If you want to take pictures, I suggest you take it before we start with the next presentation and not during. Are you ready, Ms. Skin?
Well, let me start in the meantime and then we can figure it up. It might be easier to follow in with the slides, which I think most of you have. These are the slides for the presentation today, supplementary document. Just to start off, my name is Sarah Skeen. I come from the University of Cape Town, and I work on a project called the Mental Health and Poverty Project. It's basically a mental health project working in Uganda, Ghana, Zambia, and South Africa that's being led by UCT. And we work with the ministries of health and other government partners, as well as universities in all these countries. And just to give you an outline of the presentation today, first of all, sort of based on what President Zuma said in the State of the Nation address, which was that the government is committing to the reinstatement of health programs in schools, we'd like to make the case for including mental health in school health programs and just bring and prioritizing mental health issues in schools, ensuring that learners with mental disorders are supported in the school environment, and recommended actions for the health sector as well as collaboration with for the education sector as well as collaboration with health and other sectors. To start off with, I think it's important that we have a shared understanding of what I mean when I say mental health. Mental health is not just the absence of disease. It's also a set of positive attributes which are essential to human development. The WHO calls mental health a state of well-being in which an individual realizes his or her own abilities, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about mental health. At the same time, if we look at the burden of disease of mental illness in South Africa, it's incredibly high. 17% of children and adolescents in the Western Cape have been estimated to have a mental disorder. That's children and adolescents. Adults, 1 in 6 South African adults suffer from depression, anxiety, or substance use disorders. That means that 1 in 6 adults in this room are likely to have some form of mental disorder. Approximately 1 in 3 pregnant or postpartum mothers have got depression in South Africa, which obviously affects their children as well, and it's estimated to be higher in rural areas. Over 40% of people living with HIV have got a diagnosable mental disorder in our country, but nearly 3/4 of affected South Africans are not accessing any form of mental health care. And to give you an idea of the costs that South Africa is actually incurring because of this untreated mental illness, a recent study that came out showed that there's about 28 billion rand in lost earnings every year as a result of untreated severe mental illness. It's a pity I can't get my slides up because I've got a slide which has a cycle of poverty and mental health on it. Basically, people living in poverty in our country and in other countries, low and middle income countries, are more likely to develop poor mental health for a number of reasons. These are things like high stresses, having reduced access to social capital or not having a social safety net, malnutrition, obstetric risks, and violence and trauma. At the same time, people who have poor mental health are more likely to drift into poverty because of increased health expenditure, loss of employment that often happens if someone has a mental illness, reduced productivity, and there's a huge amount of stigma around mental illness in South Africa. There's also a large amount of social exclusion and social drift, which means that people become quite isolated. So what I really want to say today is to make the case for early intervention in mental illness. Most mental orders... Oh, that's great. Let me just jump through this quickly. Most mental disorders develop early in life. About 75% of disorders actually develop before the age of 24. Let me just quickly get to where we're up to. And poor mental health, and this is a study of adolescents, is linked to a range of other negative health and social outcomes, such as violence, risky sexual health practices, substance use, and low educational attainment. A recent study of 4,000 adults in South Africa showed that disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and substance use were associated with increased odds of failing to complete secondary school. And this really shows the cycle between mental health and education. Mental ill health can lead to educational failure, and really we find often that children who are experiencing mental ill health are repeating classes more often, have poor performance academically, and are leaving school prematurely. But on the other side of the coin, increasing levels of education actually protect one's mental health, or they promote one's mental health. Through improving people's social status, increasing earning power, and by also providing optimal brain development. In a global study of mental health for children and adolescents in 2005, public schools were identified universally as a primary site for the delivery of child and adolescent mental health services. And in South Africa, we've got a range of laws and policies that support this idea. Firstly, the conventions that we've signed, various acts that are in place. And I'd also just like to focus quickly on some of our policies, which also say this. For example, White Paper 6 talks a lot about psychosocial support in the classroom and supporting learners who have got psychosocial difficulties to access the curriculum. The Child and Adolescent Mental Health Policy Guidelines from 2003 identify schools as a primary setting for providing care for children and adolescents with mental health problems as well. And at the moment, just to draw attention to the fact that the policy guidelines for improved mental health in South Africa are being updated and should be being circulated quite soon. So really what I want to do is make six recommendations about what the education sector should be doing with regards to mental health issues in our country. And the first is investing in school-based mental health promotion programs. We already have a large amount of life skills programs that are in place, mainly to do with sexual and reproductive health, but I would just urge the department to, or the ministry to invest in evaluating these and seeing which ones work. For example, there's an evaluation of a project at UCT at the moment looking at promoting healthy adolescent relationships called Respect for You. Secondly, is looking beyond life skills at whole school interventions, so such as the health promoting schools approach, which is used in this province and in some other areas of the country. And then thirdly, looking even more broadly at other types of interventions that also promote mental health, such as preventing school dropout. And in my written submission, I went into some details about initiative like this in Egypt, but there are other examples from other low and middle income countries where these programs have taken place. And then mental health and inclusive education. Psychosocial needs are specified in a number of our policies, but I think that because they are an invisible disability, they often do get forgotten in practice. So just ensuring that mental health and psychosocial disability is included in inclusive education is very important. And then, again, there are successful examples available, such as in Mauritius. Thirdly, preventing mental illness in learners through early detection and referral. I really believe there needs to be an investment in training educators to recognize learners who might have early signs of mental illness or who are at risk of developing mental disorders. And then also setting up referral systems using available resources in a district. And what I mean by that is encouraging school districts to map what resources they have, whether they're NGO or health services, and investing in the ability of people who are involved in schools, such as teachers, but also support workers in schools to provide basic mental health support to learners as well. And then, obviously, mental health does not only affect learners, but also our teachers as well, and our educators. I think there needs to be an investment in the development of an employee assistance program for educators with work-related and other mental health conditions. There's quite a well-known study that's been done which has shown how the impact of the extended role for educators in the context of HIV has led to increased levels of stress, and that added stress has affected the quality of their teaching, and also there have been higher rates of educator absenteeism. So I would advocate strongly that there needs to be some kind of budgeting for psychosocial support and possibly even outsourcing this if teachers or educators do not want to be treated in the environments in which they work. The next is integrating a mental health literacy component into the life orientation curriculum. There's a huge amount of misinformation and stigma in our community about mental health and mental illnesses, and I think it's important to do this to raise awareness about what is a very, very common but invisible problem. And then finally, intersectoral collaboration is crucial for this. I think we need to work with the Ministry of Health as well as the Ministry for Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities to ensure that we really are realising the rights of children who are affected with mental and developmental disorders. And on a final note, I think health has traditionally been seen as a kind of custodian of mental health issues. And there are a number of areas in which I think collaboration with health would be useful for the education sector. First of all, developing identification and management guidelines for educators who are working with children with these disorders. Second of all, developing employee assistance programs for educators. This is another area where potential collaboration could take place. Developing a district-based model for the management of mental health disorders in school-going children. And finally, assessing and reviewing the need for specialized mental health expertise within the education sector. Okay, that's my team.
Thank you, Ms. King. I wonder a few things. The first is, when you speak about mental health, you seem to incorporate a huge array of disorders, shall I call them disorders, from things like depression, which is something that I believe many people will suffer from in their lifetime, to almost mental illness and cognitive development issues. All of that is a huge wad to come to terms with. And I wonder if there is the kind of empirical data available that indicates, for example, to what extent we have kids in our schools with, should we say, cognitive difficulties, things like dyslexia, things like alcohol fetal syndrome, for example. We clearly, in our school setup, don't make any specific provision for these cases. And particularly, it almost now seems to me that when we speak about inclusive education, it's more of a cop-out in the sense that government doesn't have to do anything special to facilitate the inclusivity of the education system for these kids. I went to a school over the weekend where they were having an activity, and the principal lamented the fact that at least 10 students in his school suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome and were unable to cope in that school. And he was just overwhelmed. He had no resources. He barely had support staff. He's just getting by with, struggling with getting a sufficient number of teachers in his school. So, you can forget about psychologists and other specialists, social workers and so on. So it would be good, I think, one of the things, and this is how government works, is if you say that studies say X amount of students, or you can extrapolate from studies, that perhaps smaller studies, and you extrapolate into larger groups and so on, that X amount of students actually do need this kind of support, then suddenly it makes sense for us to devise policy, for us to look at, alternatives and so on. But if you have a broad suggestion, which is really what is coming out of your submission, really, that poverty does breed a whole lot of mental disorders, and they can range from this to that, less serious, more serious, whatever. That doesn't help us too much, if you're with me. And I was hoping that seeing as you made the submission, that that would be based on some studies. So perhaps if you can share with us some of the empirical data, maybe not now if you don't have them with you, but if you do have them, that would be very good. And then particularly that cycle that you were talking about when you had your slide up there where you said poverty really leads to educational failure, class repetition, poor performance at schools and so on. Again, within the South African context, are you able to share with us a study where you can show that a significant proportion of students in a particular school actually, as a result of the kind of mental health problems that they suffered, actually then went on to fail and repeat classes and so on? That kind of thing would be enormously useful to us. Members, Dr. Klopas-Lawrence, Ms. Mashishi.
You've mentioned that teachers should be trained to detect mental problems at an early stage, but what are your views about the training of teachers on how to deal with these problems in their classrooms? teach or assist the children to overcome these problems, because many of these problems are temporary and solvable. And then my second question is on the growing problem of autism, the causes thereof, and how should we deal with this problem in future? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Dr. Lopez took some of my question on the teachers that will be trained. And then maybe let me say, on those teachers that are going to be trained, are you going to select teachers, or all teachers in South Africa are going to be trained? And then I think the training will assist the learners, also the educators, because you indicated that educators also do have these mental health problems. Thank you, Chairperson.
Let me add to that and just ask whether, in fact, you know, it seems to me that as a country we tend to kind of belittle almost mental health issues, whether it's because there are other pressing issues, or whether it's simply because we're a little more stoic when it comes to these issues, is I'm not quite sure. But if one were to assess, I think, South African society generally compared with, let's say, the American society, you know, just going to a psychiatrist is something that people don't like to admit in South Africa. That being the case, and schools being reflective, essentially, of our society and our communities generally, would you say that there would be a huge need for an awareness campaign, really, amongst students about issues such as mental health, about things like depression, anxiety, stress, and all of the other factors that clearly impact on learner performance and well-being?
Okay, I'll just start with the first of those. Every statement that you can see in my presentation is based on empirical evidence. I haven't referenced it all because of, obviously, space. There is some empirical data available from South Africa. Learning difficulties such as dyslexia and that kind of thing, the data is not very strong, but I think this is obviously not a scientific way of looking at it, but on a kind of anecdotal basis, it seems that they're quite high, but there isn't very good data for that. Things like fetal alcohol syndrome. In the Western Cape, it was always thought that this was the worst place for fetal alcohol syndrome, and there were rates of close to 10%, but it's been shown in KwaZulu-Natal and in the Northern Cape that about 10% of learners in the school in various studies have got some signs of fetal alcohol syndrome. But it's a very broad disorder, so you know, you might not be as affected as severely, it would depend, but 10% show some kind of sign of it, which is very high, especially considering, I think we all think it's a Western Cape problem, but it's not necessarily. The statistic that I put up there was only for the Western Cape about mental disorders in children and adolescents, 17%. And if you look at that study more closely, it shows a breakdown for anxiety disorders, behavioral disorders, and depression, which are the three most commonly found in the Western Cape in children and adolescents. Unfortunately, beyond that, there isn't a huge amount of data for people under the age of 18, because our health surveys generally focus on people above 15. And there is a new DHS survey which has just been completed, which will show some data for 15-year-olds and over. But besides some smaller studies, there hasn't been a lot. But I still think the numbers are quite scary, to be honest. 10% and 17% is a large portion of our learners. In terms of inclusive education, and I think I'll come around to this, I think someone else mentioned this as well, is that I think what we're envisaging for South Africa is a more of a task-shifting approach to mental health care, that it doesn't necessarily need to be provided by psychologists or psychiatrists, but it can be provided by teachers or social workers or community auxiliary social workers or drug counselors that are already working in the schools and in the school districts. But there does need to be an investment in training all of these different people, depending on what district or what model a district is working with, in to have mental health competency. So that's really what I'm coming from. I don't think that it needs to be a specific type of person or service provider, but just that there is a need for an investment in training in this, because it is an issue that people do not know a lot about and often have difficulty with managing in themselves and in other people as well. In terms of South African-based evidence for school dropout, there was that one paper that I did mention where they showed that I didn't say the number, but I can look it up. But basically, already in adults in South Africa, 4,000 adults, there were a significant amount who had to drop out of school because of mental disorder. The growing problem of autism, that's quite an interesting issue, because I think you'll probably know that there's quite a lot of debate about whether it is growing or not, or whether we're just becoming better at detecting it. I would think that autism, and along with many of the mental disorders, providers require training in how to deal with these problems. Having a child with autism in the classroom, while it can be a very nice learning experience for the child and for the other children around, it also can be quite challenging. It's not something that people necessarily know how to deal with or just naturally. So I very strongly feel that there's a need for specialist training in that as well. The diagnosis is not always the most important thing. It's more about looking at where the child is battling with their education and what kind of psychosocial support they would need that would mean that they are able to access education. Like I said, I don't think that it would be a selected bunch of teachers that need to have this kind of training. I think it's applicable to everybody. One possible scenario could be selecting some districts and running a project and obviously costing it and seeing how it worked as a pilot, and then seeing from there. And then finally, I think there's a huge need for an awareness campaign. I think you'll find that many learners, although they may not identify themselves initially as having mental health problems or mental health concerns, if you dig a bit deeper, there's huge rates of violence and abuse that the children in our country are experiencing. There's a huge need for awareness amongst all age groups, but especially the children of South Africa. So I definitely would support any kind of awareness campaign on these issues.
Okay, any further last comments, members? Can I make it brief, sir?
Yeah, no, I'm going to be very, very brief. Two sentences. What would be your comment on the use of itinerant psychologists in schools? Because I know it would be very difficult to have such a person in every school, but perhaps you could make a comment on itinerant ones. I know there is a problem with the understanding of what psychologists do, especially when it comes to testing. Let's leave that out, but, you know, in the light of what you suggest, that people need assistance, I'm not talking about testing. So what would be your comment?
I think that would fit very much in with the model that I'm thinking of, which is a model where people in schools have been trained with mental health capacities, let's say, but that they can receive support and guidance from an itinerant psychologist or any other kind of mental health provider, even a mental health nurse, who is based with the school health team and then who can make support visits to schools. Mm-hmm. So this person doesn't necessarily need to see the learners even, but actually work with the staff to try and provide them with ongoing support so that they are able to deal with that learner in the school environment. If there's a very severe case, obviously, or some kind of emergency case, then that person could be more, you know, have more direct contact with learners in that scenario.
Ms. Skeen, could I just ask you then to give us the references for the empirical data that you've got, and maybe on a sort of separate crib sheet almost, if you were to just do that with whatever you can lay your hands on that you would think would be pertinent to establishing the incidences at schools, whether they've done just in one province or the country. Okay, we've... Huh? We're running out of time, members, and we're going to quickly then do our last presentation, which is Equal Education, and I see you've all come from Equal Education, and welcome to all of you. It's a pity, Mr. Hoffman, that you were not here for the beginning of the hearings, but there would have been some inputs that would be pertinent to your presentation as well that you would have missed, particularly from Media SA, which was looking at an alternative proposal almost to the proposals that you guys are making. But that's really for us to assess and analyze, not your job. I just thought it would have been worthwhile so that you could respond to some of those issues. But please, you have 10 minutes for presentation. I understand that you have got a laptop. No? No? Okay. So just going to do the hard copies. Yes, that's fine. Please, 10 minutes, and then we have 15 minutes for engagement. Huh?
Good afternoon. My name is Yolisa Duane from Equal Education. With me, I have Dimitri Holzman and Ziki and Yolanda. They're going to be talking about their own experiences with regards to school infrastructure, in particular with the libraries. And Dimitri is going to talk about policy, and I'm going to talk about libraries, infrastructure, and costing of the libraries. South Africa. It's a pity that we only have 10 minutes and we have prepared for 30 minutes.
We have 10 minutes.
As you know that in South Africa, the matric pass rate has been declining slowly from 73% since 2003 to 66% in 2006. And now it's 60% in 2009. And we also know that South African education system is in crisis, and there are many factors that do contribute to this crisis. And one of those factors is school infrastructure, poor teaching or poorly trained teachers, resources in schools, and many other factors. And today we want to focus more on school infrastructure, in particular the libraries. And Equal Education has been advocating for a national policy on school libraries for the past 12 months, since July last year. So it's almost 12 months, now it's 11 months. And we haven't had the policy that we have been calling for from the government. The crisis of education is also illustrated or is central to the crisis of illiteracy in South Africa among young black and colored kids from working class communities in this country. And if we look at the Western Cape study in 2009, it was only 86%. It was 86% learners from former white schools that passed their literacy test, compared to the 46% of former colored school kids that passed. And when we compare those numbers to the DET, that is former black schools, it was only 24% of the learners from former black schools. So surely there's a problem in South Africa if young black and colored kids are not able to read and write in their own mother tongue languages or in English, then there's clearly a problem of in education, and it is failing those young people and those communities. And also, when you look into NEEM's report 2009, that is published by the Education Department, ...3,600 schools in this country have no electricity supply. 2,400 schools have no water supply. 7,800 schools have municipal flush toilets, while 970 do not have any ablution facilities. 8% of the schools have stocked and functioning libraries. That means 92% of the schools do not have functioning library in this country. 10% of public schools in this country have stocked computer centers. 5% of public schools have stocked laboratory. Clearly, there's an issue and there's a problem with regards to infrastructure in South African schools. And also in this case, it's mainly black and colored working class children that are affected. And we can see that it does affect their outputs. That is, the young people are not able to read and write because we are not putting into the schools proper resources into the schools, apart from the fact that our teachers are poorly trained. As a first step, Equal Education is calling for this policy that deals with libraries, because it has been shown by research that if you put a well-stocked, well-functioning library with a librarian into a school, the learner achievement will increase by up to 25%. And we can show you the data on that. For example, Pearl's 2006 talks about the fact that schools that do have libraries and facilities or resources perform better than schools that do not. And also Van den Berg says also that. A South African scholar called Nick Taylor also alludes to that conclusion. So it clearly shows that there is research. It has been tested that there is a correlation between access to resources and learner outcomes. And it is a matter of equality, or rather it is because we are the Department of Education and this portfolio committee on education is tasked to provide the basic human rights to education to all children, and also provide that right to education with quality, because our constitution also guarantees everyone the right to equality, then it is our responsibility, not only as citizens of this country, but also as people that are tasked by this, by our constitution, to make sure that every school in this country, every child has proper facilities and they're able to work, and also our teachers do not carry the burden of becoming librarians whilst also they have to be teaching how to read and write. Dimitri will quickly tell us about a policy intervention, if there are, and what is the government response on this. And also, I want to also make note that Equal Education has been mobilizing around the country calling for this national policy, and also calling for government to look into issues of infrastructure. And it is important that we have a policy that deals with infrastructure and libraries in particular, because we know that it has been tested, and we know that it will provide us results, positive results on learner outcomes, that we need a tool or document that will place a legal obligation on the department to provide facilities to everyone.
Thanks, Elisa. And thank you, Chairperson. In the interest of time, I'm going to fly through and, in fact, present my part of the presentation back to front. But before actually start speaking about what intervention has been on the part of the Department of Education, I think it's important to note that Equal Education has in fact researched, Yolisa has spoken about the campaign been running for the last almost 12 months. At least 8 of those months were spent doing research into what it would cost to in fact fill this gap, which still exists in terms of school libraries. We have, as a result of that, and which was an annexure to our submission to the committee, attached our costing analysis, which is a result of that research, that ultimately shows that to build, to stock, to train the librarians, as well as to pay them for all the schools that are outstanding those services, in other words, filling that 92% gap that currently exists, it would cost the government approximately 2.2 billion rand a year over 10 years. That sounds like a lot of money at the outset, but what it actually amounts to is less than 2% of the national education budget. It's a figure and a proposal that we've put through to the department, and I've been hoping to engage as to how we can develop a plan to make that a reality. And yet, we feel that we haven't been engaged substantively on those issues that we've raised. So before we get to what interventions, and I'm going to discuss that very briefly now, that's what we've put on the table, and to say that that should be the basis for any policy or plan that is developed on the part of the Department of Education, that we'd be willing to assist in that regard. Then to speak very briefly about what I'm holding in my hand and which is not contained in the supplement which we've given to you is part of the introduction of the KwaZulu-Natal Education Department Libraries Policy Document. What that province has done has taken its own initiative and tried to develop its own provincial policy to deal with the backlogs in libraries in KwaZulu-Natal itself, and yet are recognizing that they are running into problems as well because there still exists a void nationally in terms of any kind of policy that deals specifically with libraries or infrastructure generally. I want to quote just two parts of what the KwaZulu-Natal policy document states because it gives a legislative history, and we will forward this to the committee as soon as we are done. But it gives a history and background as to the context in which the KwaZulu-Natal policy itself was developed. After naming a few draft policy documents, including a few white papers, a few discussion documents, as dating back to 1992, the document goes to speak about in 2001 that there was a Department of Education South African School Library policy that was developed. And to quote, it said that this draft national policy on school libraries was issued by the National Department of Education for comment. There was no specific engagement with provincial structures for school libraries on the draft. However, it empowered provinces to develop provincial school library policy. It attempted to shorten the original 1997 discussion document. Whilst it retained much of the thinking of the 1997 discussion document, it proposed the retention of only the one school, one library model for setting up libraries in South African schools. It also outlined the proposed implementation plan and the cost of implementing such a plan. These are words from the Department of Education itself. It goes on to state that in 2002...
Yes? That you take a minute.
Sure.
And finish up, because otherwise we won't be able to engage with you. We've got
no
less
problem.
Than 10 minutes.
Please. No problem. The last thing I want to highlight about that, and in relative to the campaign that Equal Education has been running for the last year, which calls for one school, one library, one librarian, it is not something that we have come up with ourselves. In fact, it's something that the Department of Education has been saying. We've added simply the librarian aspect to that in our campaign because we see that to have a functional library, it is important to, of course, have a full-time and qualified administrative staff to run that. And then just lastly, very recently, Parliament in 2007, in fact, gave the minister the power and authority to deal with this question and other questions relating to infrastructure quite directly. As members of the Portfolio Committee, you'll know about the Basic Education Laws Amendment Act, which brought about Section 5, Capital A, to the South African Schools Act, which gives the minister the power to provide minimum norms and standards or regulation around basic infrastructure. And if she does so, know that she must include in those regulations sections dealing with school libraries particularly. Just lastly, and most importantly, one of the responses that we have got from the Department of Education since our submission to you at the end of February has been a response that they are dealing and are creating a national policy for school libraries, a draft document which we have copies of and which is included in the supplement called the National Policy on National Guidelines on School Libraries. In a nutshell, in fact, that document itself almost makes a mockery of the obligation and responsibility that's been placed on the Department of Education, and particularly with regards to Section 5A. It provides only guidelines. It says to schools, to provinces, to districts, that it is up to them to make a choice out of the options that have been given to them by this national policy document, but in no way places responsibility on the national department. It basically says to schools that we think that libraries are important, that librarians are important, and you need to go and find a way to get that done. In our view, that falls far short of what the responsibility of the national department is, and doesn't take us any step further in terms of guiding this from a national level. We can discuss that further. We have a bit more to speak about in terms of other suggestions or proposals that have been made by the department, but
You've run out of time. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
All right. No, thank you very much. I've given you extra time for your presentation because you said you had 30 minutes, and I do know that it's quite difficult to get across everything you want to get across in 10. But we have had substantive discussions, you and I, about particularly your campaign. But let me take this opportunity and just say this much to you. It's not very often that members of Parliament get to engage with learners and students and people who are active amongst learners and students in school, and it's quite an inspiring thing to see young people taking responsibility for their own education, taking responsibility for ensuring that education is valued amongst their peers. And certainly I've been a great admirer of your various campaigns, particularly, as I mentioned to you, the campaign around getting to school on time, which I really think was one of your brightest moments, if I could put it that way. So I do want to thank Equal Education and recognize your efforts in this regard. One of the things that becomes important when we engage at this level is the issue of learning from each other. And sitting here, as I have been for many hours, with Mr. Fisser and other members of the Portfolio Committee, what I found happens in this kind of forum is that by listening to people who have expertise in their particular area, you learn a lot. And what you thought was the case turns out to be something completely different. Now, before we had this session earlier, I thought, well, you know, we must have libraries and so on. And then today we heard Media SA who were saying, well, there are alternatives, in particularly in rural areas where infrastructure is very remote, where people don't have running water, where you can actually still have literature, you can have material that enables students to meet their requirements in terms of their projects, the research that they have to conduct, and still be enormously current. And in fact, university students who are doing honors and masters and so on are using those more than they use their libraries. You will also, when you finish here, it would be very nice if you can speak to Mr. Fisser, who is sitting over there, because he's a textbook expert, and he'll tell you something very interesting, which has a direct bearing on some of the issues that you want to also put to us, which is this, that access to a book is not the end of the story. The book has got to be of a certain quality for it to have the kind of positive effect that you want to address. Because as I understand your campaign and your submission, you look at the results at schools and you look at particularly the literacy issues, and you then say, well, clearly we need more access to libraries, we need more access to books in our schools, and of course, not just for the purposes of leisure reading, but also to do well in schools, because OBE clearly requires projects to be submitted, etc., and you need that kind of research to be done. But he will say to you that having access to a textbook, for example, doesn't necessarily ensure the success of a learner. And there are many, many other dimensions around which books can actually be of assistance to you, or they cannot be of assistance to you. So clearly those are issues I'm sure you've thought about as well and so on. But it's quite an important thing, I think, that if people who are operating in the area of, and everybody is trying to improve education, trying to improve the quality of education, we're trying to improve the outcomes in our schools, it's important, I think, to engage each other and engage each other's experiences as well, to learn from each other. And this certainly is a forum that people have been using to do so. And so I do invite you and your organization to come and observe and listen. It is a public forum, and I think you'll be able to network a lot more, and it'll certainly add value to a lot of the good work that you're doing as well. Okay. Can I hear from members? Any questions? Any comments? Yes, Gosana. Anybody else? Okay, you've got about 3 minutes left. Okay, let's proceed.
Chairperson, ngiyabonga ukuthola ithuba ukuthi ngikhulume nabafundi nabothisha babo. This was a very good presentation that they made, and we appreciate the research they made, and it is clearly presented to us as a committee. Ni presente kahle siyivile, and le logo za le presentation yenu ayifani nalezi ezinye zenziwa. Lezi ezinye bekune presenter ipresenta bese si pose these questions. Oba manje is different. You are presenting in a question form to ask us ukuthi intoni esiyenza ukuze sincede. That's what you are saying, in fact. Now, engizokusho ukuthi niphethe ne-research yethu ye-education. I'm trying to address them with a matter of time, some of them, so that they can hear me. Niphethe ne-research yethu ye-education ukuthi statistics sokushoda kwama-library izikole ku-South Africa singakanani, including abo-KwaZulu-Natal ngendlela enimenshene ngayo. Kodwa-ke esifuna ukutsho ukuthi kuleso statistics enisiphethe after leyo document ye-research eniyitholile, yile document esiqabanga ukuthi isezandleni ze-department esiwaseyo. That statistics and those documents that we are quoting are in the hands of the department. And if something is in your hands, you must really take steps in order to address those things, which means the department, the government is considering all what you are saying, but is not considering for one province. That's another issue. Uma sithola inkinga, sibheka kuwo wonke ama-provinces, way 9 in South Africa. Bese kuye ngaleyo province ke uprioritize ukuthi yiphi indawo enengxaki ukudlula zonke izindawo. lezi into zenu siyazizwa zibaluleke kakhulu. These are serious problems that needs the department to pull up socks in order to address these issues. But one of the questions that I want to ask you now is that the equality of education that we're talking about in your school now, what are you doing? Is it, in fact, how is equality education in your school? In the classroom situation, are you working equally? Are you recognizing each other as learners in one class in the same grade? That equality, I should think we need more clarity from you just to explain that to us so that we can also know the classroom and the school situation in that regard. But these other issues really, I must say, is true, and we cannot sit down and say these things are not there. As you are saying, we do have this research, we do have these problems. The infrastructure is priority in this department to say lack of infrastructure throughout the country. But in terms of priorities, according to the provinces, according to the villages, and the poor community in particular, the rural areas are those communities where we experience this poor infrastructure and the problem of infrastructure in those areas. I should think let's work together. Even those infrastructures that we have put on the ground or in place, try to protect them. Lezo's goles lakile, Lezo's library, ezikhona nani ke kufuneka ukuthi nisincede ukuthi masizivikele. Singathi masibheke lezi ezishodayo kube ezinye ziyamoshwa nalezi ezikhona. Masingavumi kube nomunye ozawumosha iy'nkolo zethu namalibrary wethu. Ndiyabulela, thank you very much.
You can see Mr. Kosana as a school teacher, eh? You can't stop talking. And then we've got a school principal here who's going to give you another lecture.
No. I just want to support the proposal by the gentleman that it would be a very good thing if every school could have a librarian. In fact, I want to start with the librarian, not with the library. If you could have a librarian, because once a librarian is employed, you are forced to have a library. We have a lot of libraries without librarians in this country. And I can give you examples. You go to some schools, when you get there, books are stacked in a storeroom because there is no librarian there, they are not being used. It's not a question of not having a library, because the moment books are delivered in a school, or the moment the principal orders books for the library and they are stored in a storeroom or in a classroom, without somebody controlling